Tonight on The Download, Chicago poet and author of The People's History of Chicago, Kevin Koval. Former Chicagoan and director of Kong Skull Island, Jordan Boat Roberts. Jazz cellist Tamika Reed. And stand-up comedians Kristen Toomey and Rena Kong. And now, here's your host, a man who just finished a full glass of Lake Michigan ice water, now with chromium, Justin Kaufman.
Tastes so good.
Yum.
Mmm. Of course. Why not? Why not spill into the lake? We don't need the water. Good evening. Welcome to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We've got a great show lined up for you. Alderman Brian Hopkins is going to join us coming up here in the 7:30 hour. We're going to talk about policing in some of the communities that he represents in the 2nd Ward. We've had Alderman Hopkins on before, and it's really interesting because his ward is the most sort of gerrymandered ward of Chicago politics. It represents everything from where we're sitting, Michigan Avenue, to Old Town, to Ukrainian Village, to so many different areas that are having similar struggles when it comes to safety and crime and things that are happening in the city of Chicago. But obviously, because of the location, it's different. So we'll talk with the alderman about what he thinks about the future of policing those areas, security, crime, and also looking at private-public partnerships, not unlike we've talked about with the Metropolitan Planning Council and others on the show, about whether or not we might see a more sort of privatized police force in some of these areas. And that's something that that's something that we definitely can see happening in the city of Chicago as resources and budget items are tight. So we'll talk with Alderman Hopkins coming up here in the 7:30 hour. At 8 o'clock, my guest at the big table, poet Kevin Koval. Kevin's been on the show before. He's got a new book called The People's History of Chicago. Talk with him about the poems in the new collection, which really does give a different, unique look at the history as we know it here in the city of Chicago. Kevin Koval, of course, the artistic director at Young Chicago Authors. He's the founder of Louder Than a Bomb, the Youth Poetry Festival. The foreword of this book is from Chance the Rapper. I mean, there's a lot that Kevin has been involved with in mentoring and nurturing young talent here in the city of Chicago. We'll talk to Kevin about his new book and the young talent. Also coming up at 9 o'clock, Jordan Boat Roberts is going to join us, the filmmaker, the director of Kong Skull Island, a former Chicagoan, went to Columbia College here in town. We'll talk to him about jumping from indie films to super blockbusters. You know, getting all artistic, going black and white with King Kong. He didn't get that to happen. So we'll talk with Jordan, who's a great filmmaker. Looking forward to having him on the program. Also tonight, Tamika Reed is here. Great jazz cellist. Me in the studio. She's got a big show at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra on Friday. So we'll talk with Tamika. And we'll play the worst tonight. We're back, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Kristen Toomey, Rena Kalm in studio. I'm so excited. This is a great show tonight. So let's get to it. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. Take a break. We'll come back. Do the carryout. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time to get this show on the road. So why don't we start with carryout? This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The president was in Kenosha today. You know what? Sorry, I forgot to put on my Kenosha filter. Let me try this again. The president was in Kenosha today. Go Pack. Kenosha. That's really all I got. That's the extent of the Kenosha experience right there. President Trump unveiled a new executive order to review who gets H-1/B visas. This is to possibly crack down on foreign skilled workers coming to this country to take American jobs. But since we're talking about less than 60,000 visas, this is more of a USA, USA than fixing any current issue. I'm not sure how many out-of-work Kenosha factory workers were passed over at Google. Maybe a ton, but probably maybe not. The jobs in question are in the tech sector, also in the fashion industry, where the first lady, yes, Melania Trump, once had an H-1B visa. When hearing this, President Trump's response?
I did not know that.
Then he went bowling. That's what he did. Also today, it was made public that the aircraft carrier and strike team that was supposed to be on its way to North Korea isn't anywhere near North Korea. It's in Australia. It took a reporter snooping through the gram to realize that they were 3,500 miles south of where the White House said they were. The response from the White House? Why do you still listen to us? You know that fake news thing? Well, that's us. We do that. So the stare down that was reported for the last couple days between North Korea and the U.S., non-existent. Not a great moment for us, the American people. Yeah, I don't need to know where the Navy's currently at. I don't. I really don't. But getting everyone all tense about, I don't know, nuclear war? Kind of lame, right? Especially that was fake. Former Governor Rod Blagojevich is appealing, hoping for a... No, you know what? Let's go ahead and pass on that one. It seems like that's a story for every third Friday of every month. A new study ranking best cities in America named Naperville number 2 in the whole country. Really? Ann Arbor was number 1. One of the reasons Naperville was named number 2 is because of its close proximity to Chicago, where residents can go for entertainment and fun. Oh, okay. So where does Chicago rank? That's a good one. Didn't even register. Didn't even show up on the list. I mean, come on. The survey was based on schools and safety. But Chicago has unlicensed party buses, so that's pretty cool. It's got to count for something. Mayor Emanuel is vowing to crack down on unlicensed party buses. What? What? You're going to take that away? That's all we had going. Unlicensed party buses. A new ordinance is being floated in city council to give hotel workers a panic button to alert authorities if they're in danger or need assistance. So next time you ask for more pillows, make sure you do it nicely, or you'll be asking for more pillows at county. I say a panic button isn't enough. I say go trap doors next. So if you're arguing about your stay, boom, hit the button and you're banished to the dungeon boiler room like Jabba the Hutt. Right? Then you have to be a Jedi to kill that weird animal that's in the boiler room. Something like that. Now it's time for the Downloads Lake Michigan Water Break. Now with Chromium. Tastes like rusty nachos. And that was the Downloads Lake Michigan Water Break. A new species was found in the Philippines. It's a giant shipworm, which measures in at 5 feet long. And it looks like something you never, ever, ever, never want to look at. Seriously, do not Google it. Don't do it. I'm telling you, don't do it. Ah, you did it. You know what it looks like? It looks like when you squeeze cranberry out of the can, but the can was 5 feet long and it wasn't cranberry, but a prehistoric worm. Does that make sense? But interesting, the worm is so gross, it defies cell logic. It feeds off bacteria that usually would make humans sick. So there you go. This gross cranberry worm could save our species. All right. Good talk. In weather, too windy for me. I'm a purist. It just wasn't nice. Nice enough. In sports, the Blackhawks lost a heartbreaker last night in overtime to teeter on the brink of elimination. The number one seed Hawks are down 3-0 to the Predators. They've been in this situation before. Maybe not this particular situation. But the future is grim. Although last night, two of those Predator goals, freakish, right? Sham, if you ask me. Including the one where the Predator dude interfered with Crawford by hitting his head. But you know what? That's hockey, I guess. Or not. It's illegal. Thursday night's game 4, the biggest stat to take home, Hawk fans. Dating back to the regular season, the Hawks have lost 7 in a row, as Pete Zimmerman has been telling us for the past couple months.
Never peak too early.
That's right. Tonight, the Bulls look to get up 2 games on the number 1 seed Celtics. Right now, they're taking the lead. They are whooping up 25-15 in the first quarter, beating Boston on their home court. Man. You know what? The number one advantage in the first game was rebounding. The Bulls got big. If they continue, they might have a chance here. Can you imagine? A month ago, if I told you the Bulls would have more playoff success than the Hawks, what is going on? Ups and downs and topsy-turvy. Dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria. The Bears' offseason moves will wrap up next week with the draft, but lots to look for in the next couple weeks, including whether or not Kyle Long will be healthy for 2017. He had surgery on his ankle and didn't go well. So instead of fixing his shoulder, which was also his labrum is torn. He said, nah, you know what? I'm done with surgeries. I'm good. Just remember that. Tuck that nugget of info away for November when they're like, Kyle Long, out with a shoulder injury. Also, the Bears better pick a quarterback in the draft, right? I'm just saying. I mean, this better not be one of those cute drafts where we found a tight end in a small college in the Virgin Islands. I don't know. Nobody knows about him. He could be great. No, just stick with a champ. Deshaun Watson. Come on. In baseball, the Cubs are back at it with the Brew Crew tonight at Wrigley. Javi at short, John Jay in center. Addison Russell takes a seat. Shuffling the Cubs lineup is like Tetris. Also, the Cubs have lost four in a row, and they haven't done that. I mean, really, they haven't done that in like 1 year. Sorry. I was going to say my lifetime, but really, it's only been 1 year. The upstart Pirates got some bad news. All-star outfielder Starling Marte suspended for 80 games for performance-enhancing drugs. Eek. The White Sox in the Bronx take on the Yankees. Todd Frazier out again with flu-like symptoms, missing his third straight game. Yikes. Get some Theraflu up in there. And finally tonight, Russians have disputed the claim that they're sending an armed robot to space to guard/protect the International Space Station. Critics are calling the Russian robot the Terminator. The Russians are like, no, it's not the Terminator. It's more like Ivan Danko from Red Heat. No word if they're sending up a Jim Belushi robot to accompany him, or maybe just Jim Belushi in general, because, you know, work is kind of slowed down. That's the carryout for April 18th, 2017. Hey, in honor of Tax Day today, we're giving you no discounts. Nope. If anything, you should pay us. All right, coming up, Alderman Hopkins will be here. We'll talk about safety, security, private, public, what we can expect from the future policing of Chicago neighborhoods. Alderman Hopkins in studio here on The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I don't want to start a riot unnecessarily up and down Michigan Avenue, but look at these Bulls.
8-point lead.
Nikola Mirotic lighting it up. Robin Lopez. Who are these guys? Rajon Rondo? Former Celtic?
I love the early sort of the preview where all the Celtics were like, we know Rajon Rondo is going to play up because he plays big for national games. Not so much for everybody else, but just for big games. Like, they kept saying that over and over. I'm like, that doesn't bode well for the character of that player. It's like, we know Rajon only plays when the lights are on.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, but hey, that's what they
wait
for.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I
was looking at their minutes played, by the way. Nikola Mirotic has 10 points.
10 points. Yeah, 10 well, still, points that's played. Better than he did in game one. All right, you know, he was feeling Bobby Portis, so we'll see. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, A People's History of Chicago, poems by poet Kevin Koval. Kevin, of course, the artistic director for Young Chicago Authors, one of the founders of Louder Than a Bomb. We'll talk with Kevin about his new work, about interpreting history. Great to have him on. He'll be my guest at the big table coming up at 8 o'clock. My next guest is one of the tougher jobs in Chicago politics. Alderman Hopkins represents the Second Ward, a ward that encompasses so many different communities. So issues like crime, safety, and overall quality of life differ from condo dwellers along Michigan Avenue in Streeterville to the homeowners in Ukrainian Village to the renters in Old Town. And I'm only talking about a few of the communities represented. But Alderman Hopkins is really in a unique position to see firsthand the issues and needs of residences in a big city like Chicago and what can be done about said issues when the city and the police force are maxed out. Alderman Hopkins joins us from time to time here on The Download. Talk about these issues and more. Alderman, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me back.
So let's start. I feel like every time there's a big news story, I read two paragraphs down, and it's like a statement from Alderman Hopkins' office. I mean, the 12-year-old boys, the two boys who were shot in Old Town, sort of caught in the crossfire, that's your ward. Talk about this issue, because this is one of those that you know the situation, the drug trade, and some of the things that are happening in Old Town firsthand.
Yeah, I do represent part of Old Town. I actually share that with Alderman Burnett. The instance you're referring to happened right on the border of Alderman Burnett's ward and my ward. And the two of us both responded in our own way, which was kind of an interesting approach because we had very different responses to that. But it was two 12-year-old boys, and they were literally on their way to the candy store.
They were waiting for a store to open.
They were waiting for the candy store to open. And also caught in the crossfire was a 67-year-old maintenance man who happened to be employed at the housing complex where the both the shooter and the victim were connected to in the drug trade. So these were three innocent people at both ends of the age spectrum, very young, innocent children, and an older gentleman who was doing an honest job. You know, he was someone who probably didn't grow up with many advantages, but he chose an honest life to work as a maintenance guy, had been there for many, many years, clean employment record, you know, certainly didn't deserve to be shot, just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, you know, it's a tragedy on many levels. And
but this came out, you mentioned the drug trade. This comes out of a complex there that you firsthand have seen how the drug trade, like the cars are backed up. And you mentioned in the statement in the article, you talked about, you know, seeing cars, you know, sort of drug handlers move from one place to another and cars waiting for the drug. I mean, as the alderman, and you know specifically where the trouble spot's at, how does it continue?
Yeah, I happened to personally witness a drug sale in that same location just a couple weeks prior to the shooting. I was in my car, and I saw a car ahead of me pull out into the middle of the street, honk the horn, you know, watch the guy come from the corner, exchange the plastic bag for cash, and he had the nerve to walk away from the car at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, broad daylight, counting his cash. Like, he was that unafraid that he was going to get pinched or anyone was going to stop him. So, you know, I called 911, of course, right away, and then I called the police commander to let him know. And they're aware of it. They know what's going on. Alderman Burnett is very aware of it, too. In fact, after this initial shooting, Alderman Burnett took some steps to prevent a revenge escalation because he knew some of the families involved, and he was able to do that. So it isn't that we don't know what's happening. It's just a very difficult problem to solve. You know, we've tried mass incarceration, and that didn't work. You know, there's always one drug dealer who is willing to replace another one when that one leaves, you know, a lucrative spot. As long as there's demand, you know, there's going to be someone who's willing to be enterprising and sell. You know, the best that we can hope for is a city and as police officers that we can get involved when the violence escalates. And that's what's really happening across the city.
Absolutely. And I think about everyone from residents in Old Town, who this happens right there on Sedgwick or whatever the address was where this happened. I know, you know, community groups in Bucktown, Wicker Park, you know, Ukrainian Village get together, say that they see crime is on the rise. How do you, as the alderman, when you have so many different disparate communities that all are sort of, you know, similarly talking about the same things about crime, how do you address those things when each one of those communities have a different sort of crime that's happening in their ward
well,
or their district?
Yeah, there's different approaches, but the feeling is universal. If you don't feel safe in your neighborhood, if you don't feel safe in your city, really not much else is going to matter to you. If you think you're at risk when you walk out the door of either being shot, caught in the crossfire, or possibly targeted if you are a gangbanger and you're involved in the drug trade, or if you just think that you're going to be targeted for robbery, and we've seen that increase in some of the neighborhoods that I represent. I don't necessarily have too many drive-by gang-related shootings, but I do have a lot of muggings and purse snatchings and even sexual assaults that have been occurring at disturbingly high rates lately. People don't feel safe right now, and that cuts across all neighborhoods.
What can you do about it? As the alderman, what can you do about it?
We have been advocating for additional police officers, and that was something that came up during my campaign. Practically every debate we had, every community town hall meeting we had, people were crying out for more police officers. We're down probably about 2,000 officers from where we had a peak of 14,000 sworn officers. We're down to about 12,000 now. The mayor's committed to adding 1,000 and filling 500 vacancies for a net gain of 1,500 over the next couple of years. More police can help. That's one thing we can do. It doesn't solve some of these underlying social problems, the social injustice that drives this, the, you know, broken homes, lack of economic opportunity, failing schools. All those things take a lot longer of an approach to solve. But the one thing that we can do right now is change the way we deploy our police officers, have better training for them, which is very important, and have more of them on the street so they can respond.
Well, I mean, you said it yourself. I mean, the mayor has made a commitment to filling vacant police officers, also to add more, but it still doesn't get to the number that the city once had. I mean, do you have to, at a certain point, because of the realistic look at Chicago's finances, say, you know what, maybe we have to think about a public-private partnership where there are private security forces, there are private police officers that are on the street that are patrolling Bucktown, Wicker Park, Old Town, to sort of give non-emergency support to the Chicago Police Department.
Yeah, in fact, I proposed that for one area that I represent, Bucktown and Wicker Park in particular. There's a special service area there. It's currently working quite well in the neighborhood around Wrigley Field, represented by Alderman Tunney, and the East Lakeview Chamber of Commerce has employed that. I've suggested it to the Chamber of Commerce in my ward, and we're in ongoing discussions. They're somewhat skeptical about that.
Why are they skeptical? What's the skeptic?
Well, I think the skepticism is driven by this idea that there would be, you know, sort of a brown shirt private force accountable to no one, you know, the stormtroopers that kind of kick down your door. That's not at all what we're proposing. This would be a supplement to the Chicago police officers. It wouldn't be a replacement for them. It would be someone that could assist them possibly in responding, just another set of eyes and ears on the street. And my plan would make great use of off-duty Chicago police officers who can work in their off time for a private security company. They are still sworn officers and they're still trained. They're, you know, licensed to carry firearms and they have handcuffs even when they're not working. So it would be just another set of extra eyes and ears on the street that would have the power of law enforcement.
And I can understand. I mean, I play devil's advocate. I can understand where a community would say they don't necessarily want a police force that does not have accountability. We've seen that sort of play out even today, the jury awarding, to someone who was they felt was wrongfully shot. But the concept being that, you know, without accountability, how do you make sure that you don't run into a situation where you have a rogue private police force that does things that take away a community's rights?
Yeah, and that's why I'm trying to draw a distinction. This wouldn't be, you know, a rogue private police force. It would be publicly funded. You know, the money for an SSA actually works like property taxes. It's paid for by businesses. You know, and it's collected almost like property taxes are collected. So there's some natural accountability there, especially for the firms that employ private security and Chicago police officers. They have to be state certified. They have to be licensed, bonded, insured. Right. Training is an issue. That is definitely something that you have to be very careful about. But that's an issue for the sworn blue shirts of the Chicago Police Department right now, too.
Alderman Brian Hopkins in studio. He's the second ward alderman. We're talking about the issues of safety, security, crime, and other issues as well that affect the communities, the vast communities that he represents, everything from downtown here in Streeterville to Wicker Park, to Old Town, everything in between. It is interesting as you talk about the differences between the neighborhoods, because what might be good for, say, Michigan Avenue may not be that great for Wicker Park. And I think about you're involved in the Street Performers Ordinance, which is a little bit controversial in the way of limiting what can be done for street performances downtown and how that affects the city. But also I think about, you know, downtown has so much more opportunity to work with the corporate side, to work with, I think of Northwestern University with their private police force, to find a way to expand, to cover residents, to cover issues of crime and security here in the area. I mean, can you count on, when you think about just, let's talk about downtown, can you count on some of those organizations, some of those businesses, some of the corporate side to help out in trying to make a neighborhood safer?
Oh, absolutely. I'm working with Northwestern University right now.
Because they have a private police force.
Yeah, well, they work for the university, which is a private university. So in that sense, they are private. But they do have to go through the State Police Academy in Springfield, just like any other municipal law enforcement officer would have to in order
to be
trained.
But their primary duty is to protect the university.
To protect the campus community.
Right,
and now the question is, where does the campus community begin and end?
Right.
And in Evanston, where, of course, you know, the main part of Northwestern University is based, they have an agreement with the city of Evanston. And they basically, you know, expand their boundaries for purposes of protecting people. Because when you're on your way to and from campus, you're part of the campus community, even though you might be, you know, say a half a mile from the dorm where you live or the building where you're taking your classes. And you're entitled to that protection because you're a member of that community. Same thing applies here in Streeterville, where Northwestern University has their law school. And of course, the hospital has the med school affiliated with it. And there's quite a lot of activity there coming and going, people who are a part of the campus community or visiting the campus community. So we're suggesting that their police officers be empowered to expand their borders.
Same idea. Yes, Evanston, right?
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, just last month I happened to witness someone snatched an iPhone on the campus, and you see those blue security lights around the campus where, you know, you can go and activate it, call the university police. Someone called the university police on one of the blue light phones at the same time someone else who witnessed it called 911. So both the Chicago police and the Northwestern University police responded to the same crime independently of each other, chased the same person from two different directions, and caught him at Chicago and State.
Well, I'm
at
glad
the
they
same
got their
time.
iPhone back.
So they got they got the offender. You know, they caught the guy. And Chicago and State is definitely not on the campus of Northwestern University.
I mean, obviously, the cynic in me says that's great for someone who got their iPhone snatched. You'd like to see that kind of partnership for bigger ticket items like gun violence and things like that, gangs as well. You know, for you as someone who represents such vast different communities, when the street performer ordinance is a perfect example. Maybe great for people who live on Michigan Avenue, like, oh, great, we don't have to have somebody banging the drums at 10 o'clock at night. We can finally get some rest. Banging the drums is sort of the heartbeat of a neighborhood like Wicker Park. They don't like the idea that you want to put restrictions on street performance. How do you deal with that when you may be doing one community well and the other not so much?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, 2 years into the job here, and this is really the first time that I find myself in a situation where I have a geographic disagreement over an initiative that I'm supporting. You know, I think back to when I was a candidate and I visited every neighborhood in this ward, and my message was the same. I didn't change it based on what neighborhood I was in. It was the same message. So I naively thought, hey, maybe I can just always please my entire ward. Right. I'm never going to have one neighborhood support something and another neighborhood oppose it. And that hasn't happened until now. But I do have to say, with the street performer ordinance in particular, the downtown residents on the east side of my ward love this idea. And we hear from them constantly. Alderman Riley, too, who's my co-sponsor with this, they think this is the best ordinance they've heard the city council debate in a long time. On the west side of my ward, not so much, you know, especially Wicker Park, Bucktown. You know, we're a few years removed from the Around the Coyote heyday when those neighborhoods were really just an artist haven.
Yeah, right.
But that legacy still remains there. And they think I should just leave the street performers alone. Don't touch them. Let them play all they want. Make as much noise as they want. So, you know, I'm really caught in the middle on this one, trying to please the east side of my ward, and the west side has a different idea.
We'll have to see how that plays out. Alderman Brian Hopkins of the 2nd Ward in studio with us tonight. You got to come back and tell us how that plays out, as well as the issues of private-public partnerships and security and crime in Chicago. Alderman Hopkins, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, broadcasting live on Michigan Avenue here in Chicago. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, filmmaker Jordan Vogt Roberts is going to join us. Very excited to have him. He is the director of Kong Skull Island. Went to Columbia College here in town. Worked with the legendary stand-up outfit Blurreds with T.J. Miller, Kumail, a lot of other Pete Holmes. And now he is directing blockbuster movies in California, Chicago Takeover. So, Jordan, join us in the 9 o'clock hour. Well, it's often said that history is written by the winners. And because of that, we rarely are given the real story of what happened, what shaped our society, the country, our cities. Because in large part, the stories of the indigenous, the working class, the poor, they're erased or pushed aside to make way for a more marketable narrative. And that's no different here in the city of Chicago, whether we're talking about the Founders or the Haymarket Riot. There's alternate versions of how and what went down. Enter Kevin Koval, the longtime poet and writer, has penned a new collection of poetry called A People's History of Chicago, put out by Haymarket Press. Kevin, of course, the artistic director at Young Chicago Authors and the founder of Louder Than the Bomb, the citywide poetry competition, which I can't even, I mean, we're not even going to start. That's crazy how big that has become. It's a worldwide phenomenon at this point. He's also the editor of the Breakbeat Poets, New American Poetry in the Age of Hip Hop, and he is my guest tonight. Kevin, good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
All right, before we start, let's start with a reading, right? Let's go right, because this is a collection of poems, like we said. Why don't we start with LaSalle Wrote It Down Wrong?
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you. LaSalle Wrote It Down Wrong, 1687. Gringoed the whole place after word, every street and building, some flat mispronunciation, some misshapen mouth, some murder. Chicagua, wild, garlic in indigenous utterance, some funk music, some rampant weed returning, perennial and persistent. Chicago is malignant, a mass of machinery built upon mass graves, the beginning of a long death march, an inadequate water down, an eraser, pink as the white man's tongue.
You know, I hear that, and the other poems as well. There's a chronological aspect to this, you know, obviously a people's history of Chicago. But there, I mean, that poem, of course, talking about the origins of the city as we know it. But this goes all the way through to some of the current issues that we face today in Chicago. Talk about why you took this on. Why have a collection of poetry that follows a sort of historical arc?
Well, I think I wanted to account for, you know, some of what you mentioned in the intro. I wanted to account for some of the working class victories, some of the hard fought victories that working people in the city have made to make the city better, to make the country better. I wanted to put on for Chicagoans who I think really, you know, innovated and revolutionized global culture. Some folks we don't really put on for enough. I think that we have a tendency in the city sometimes to not really champion our own. I hope that that's changing. But I wanted to do that work. I also wanted to, in some ways, I think, counter some of the dominant narrative that exists about our city currently. You know, we have historically, in some ways, a bad reputation from outsiders looking in, but even I think some of our own. And I wanted to tell, you know, in the best way that I could, a broader spectrum of the experience and some of the people who are here.
You know, and you think about the fact that, you know, there has been a people's history. I mean, Howard Zinn and the concept of telling a different history or examining what we know as a collective society about history and telling the stories that may have fallen through the cracks. Was that an inspiration for you to do that? I mean, or is this really just about telling the right story for Chicago?
Well, of course. I mean, Howard Zinn and his work as a historian, as an advocate, and as a writer has historically been a profound impact in my own life and certainly my writing. You know, Howard, the folks who run Haymarket Books were Howard's literary agents, and also Howard published with Haymarket before he transitioned, and had the opportunity to meet him a few times through the folks at Haymarket. And I think that when I read that book, A People's History of the United States of America, it kind of, you know, confirmed some of the things that I had intimated just as a young, very young person, that, you know, systematically in our education, I was being lied to. And Howard's book, along with the historian Lerone Bennett Jr. and other folks, you know, confirmed these suspicions. And I think what I wanted to do was write a history book that was for young people in Chicago now, in high school, in college, and everybody, that we can also begin to kind of take back some of the narrative that exists about our city historically and currently, and begin to also, you know, tell some of the great things about our city.
Do you consider yourself a history buff? I mean, is something that you paid attention to Chicago history?
I have. I mean, I think hip hop made me a historian, you know, and I think that it taught me to dig into the record. And, you know, I think being a Jew also made me, you know, retell history constantly, but to make it relevant now. And I think in order to do that, you have to riff on, you know, some of the themes of, you know, what we've forgotten and make history relevant. You have to tell the compelling story. I think that's what, you know, the rabbis did for thousands of years. We call it, you know, Talmud and the Midrash, and I think hip hop does that in a similar way, you know, where it takes these forgotten bits of the record and it finds the fresh sample, it finds a beautiful moment, something that is past, and it brings it to make it contemporary.
You know, it's so interesting to think about, you know, sort of the way that history is taught to us as young people. It says, you know, I think middle school, high school, then you get to college, you start to really learn how to question that history. And I think about, you know, I was telling you when we started that, you know, my 9-year-old son had a book project on DuSable. And I said, okay, we'll start, you know, I'll start looking some stuff up. And I went down the rabbit hole on a bunch of questioning of why people didn't recognize that DuSable was the original founder of the city, where he came from, what happened, and historians sort of arguing back and forth. I mean, it was such a complicated narrative that is still being argued in history circles today. But it just goes to show you that with further examination, there is obviously more things to learn.
Yeah, and we have to contend the dominant narrative always. You know, I think that there's a reason why. I mean, one of the things that I really loved about researching publishing this book and writing this book is that, you know, I mean, I've known about and have, you know, been inspired by some of the work and the organizing and you know, the speeches of Chairman Fred Hampton. But the work that he was trying to do to build these interracial coalitions between the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, and the Young Patriots. It's part of the reason why he was assassinated by the Chicago Police Department and the FBI. Because, I mean, when working people have come together across the boundaries that the city tries so desperately to keep erect before either they meet and build with one another, I think that that's what troubles the center the most.
And history has a way of washing, you know, the idea that, you know, at a certain point something is complicated or it doesn't fit the narrative. It just kind of gets left to the side or certain details are left out. Fred Hampton's a great example of, you know, where the way I'm taught about that story is, these violent you know, Black Panthers and, you know, there and next story, next year. You right. know, and you move on from that, but you find out as you get deeper that there's much, much more to it.
Right. I mean, we literally walk over history. I mean, there's a small emblem or, you know, something to commemorate the Haymarket riot. And, you know, these are working people who ensured that, you know, at least we have an 8-hour day. And, you know, where is their monument? Where is, you know, I mean, Chicago made working people, made, you know, the bourgeois class more accountable to working people and have done that consistently, you know, through organizing efforts, putting their lives, their bodies, their family, their livelihood on the line in order to ensure that workers have a better look in the city. And of course, we have a long way to go. But I think part of the reason why I also wanted to write the book is because I wanted us to know that we also have won. You know, we have a rich history of winning as well. And particularly in this moment where there's so much divisiveness between working class communities in a moment of radical unlistening where we don't do a great job of really hearing one another. I think the power is when we come together actually across those boundaries and really build solidarity.
Kevin Koval's my guest. He's the author of A People's History of Chicago, a collection of poetry. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll read some more and continue the conversation at the big table here with Kevin Koval. Stay with us.
Albert Parsons Can Hang, November 11th, 1887. A dumb kid of privilege, a son of the South, a descendant of the American Revolution. As a boy, he fought with the Confederates. As a man, he apologized to the Black woman who raised him. A lover of Lucy, part mestizo and Black radical socialist, more dangerous than 1,000 rioters, a typesetter like my grandfather, a believer in the rights of the worker, an 8-hour day, an 8 to sleep, an 8 to play, a ringer of the alarm, a white tiger before Huey maybe, dynamite Jimmy Walker, an organizer in the good times, summer Sunday beer gardens, a longing for bread or blood. A leader in the rise of the working class, a target the barons went after, an albatross to the merchant prince Marshall Field, a defendant in the Haymarket riot, no evidence, no fair jury, railroaded by George Pullman, Albert Parsons, a white man to become, a white man who acted, a white man unbound by guilt, a prisoner in cell 29, a writer live from death row.
That's poet Kevin Koval. His new book, A People's History of Chicago, is out now. It really chronicles Chicago history from people's perspective. He's the artistic director of Young Chicago Authors, as well as the founder of Louder Than a Bomb, in studio at the Big Table tonight. That poem's a great example. You're talking about the Haymarket riot, of course, the trial, everything that went along with it. We were just talking about the 8-hour day. You know, it's interesting because you're a poet. So you choose poetry as your form, your vehicle, your mechanism to tell these stories. Is that the best mechanism for you to tell these stories? I mean, or why not do the 600-page Howard Zinn style?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think that's something about this moment, even in our cultural attention span, where the poem seems right. You know, it's not too long. You know, it can get you. And then hopefully, I think the poem will do for people, for you know, what kind of hip-hop music did for me is that hopefully will open up a Pandora's box of research. It will, you know, set somebody kind of on fire about an idea and kind of, you know, it'll be a bone that you won't be able to let go of in some ways. And, you know, I believe in content over form. And so, I mean, these are poems, but, you know, some of them read and look like prose on the page. Some of them are formal. There's villanelles and there's found poems and there's, you know, all sorts of, you know, there's an erasure poem where I took some language on the city of Chicago's website about the graffiti blasters and, you know, used their language, but right. I buffed their right, website right. in order to get right, a poem right, out right. of it. And so, you know, I don't know. I think that there's something about this moment where there has been a real return to the oral poetic in our culture, you know, thankfully. And in some ways, it's the most ancient of storytelling traditions, the poem, the song. But I think it's also perfect for grabbing one's attention, particularly in the classroom.
I was going to say, know? I mean, who's the audience here? Well, are you looking for young people? I mean, for young people to sort of to digest this and understand their history, to maybe sort of be a jumping off point to try and understand Chicago history in a different way?
And I think it's also the invitation to, you know, document and write your own as well. I mean, I think that's the hope. And you know, the Lannan Foundation, who's been a partner of Haymarket and mine for some time now, you know, they bought, you know, copies of the book for every young poet in the festival this year, as well as every high school for the English and history department. And so the hope over this year is to really kind of work with teachers and, you know, potentially CPS in order to kind of get the book inside of some curricular spaces as well. And really the idea is, yes, I mean, maybe young people will have a better, richer understanding of what Chicago history looks like, but really then maybe they'll begin to kind of, you know, ask their parents and their grandparents about their stories and then begin to really document their own. That, you know, I believe as a poet that the canon is so far from closed, we're constantly adding to it, and that history is that as well. You know, none of this is in a museum. You know, it's happening currently. You know, we're making history in this moment, and young people are the best purveyors.
How important is it as a poet, as a Chicago poet, when you're writing poems about Chicago history, to include your own story? You know, you mentioned your grandfather in here. I mean, just to have that sort of frame of reference or that jumping off point, is that, how important is that as a writer to sort of play off your own history?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm in the book some, you know, and I mean, somebody was pointing out that there are a lot more poems after 1975 than before 1975. and there's no mistake in that. I think that, of course, you know, I associate my story with the story of Chicago. I mean, my family, you know, moved here from the Ukraine and Poland to be saved in a lot of ways. And so, you know, they took refuge in Chicago. And I wish Chicago was more of a sanctuary and a city of refuge for all people, you know, and we, even folks who have come, you know, from the South, folks who have come from other countries, I think we need to continue to ensure that it is a city of refuge, a sanctuary for all. We do a really poor job of that as a city. And I think the sanctuary that it gave my family, it really should give to all of its citizens who are seeking a safe space here.
Well, we'll get to some more current poetry, some of the stuff from current history. We'll read some more, and we'll also talk about your work at Young Chicago Authors, which is constantly checked here on the download. I mean, we have artists come through, and it's always, you know, talking about that experience. I was at the Young Chicago Authors. I mean, there's a lot that goes into that, and we'll talk. Kevin Koval, the artistic director of Young Chicago Authors, also a poet. His new book, A People's History of Chicago, is out now. We'll take a quick break and update the news with Rob Martier, and we'll come back and continue the conversation with Kevin Koval. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, the 9 o'clock hour, Jordan Vogt Roberts is going to join us, the director. Also, Tamika Reed's going to be here, a cellist, jazz cellist. She's going to be at Chicago Symphony Orchestra coming up on Friday as part of a big jazz performance, part of their series. Looking forward to having Tamika in studio as well, talk about her career. And at 10 o'clock, Kristen Toomey and Rena Kalm in studio to play the worst. We got a big show, but hey, we're continuing. Kevin Koval.
Cities celebrate Independence Day, July 4th through the 7th, 2014. 1. Midwest weekenders gather at the lakefront, blue eyes over Navy Pier. The breeze has ease, distant light jazz, a cacophony of calm and citronella. The sky on fire above the mighty Michigan boasts. Penthouses, sailboats, stock sunburnt faces alight in laughter and light beer. A lightness here, a whiteness, a luxury to hear blasts and not flinch or think someone you love is not. Here is not a land of blood or body. All remains remain well. Deposit box inheritance. The future aright, bright, awash in light. The holiday is every day. Two. Neighborhoods will bloom tonight. Many arsenals stockpiled from Indiana, smoke and fire in the streets and alleys. Corner boys and working fathers make the sky burn. The light on the block warms the faces of little ones. Mothers on stoops finally sitting for a moment to watch dusk turn the color of candy. Bustelo cans are cannons. Roman candles in county men's hands launch fireballs into the dark, raging against the stars. Downtown, the 1812 overture will whisper gently over the water, but here, quarter sticks of dynamite, bass drum, a requiem for the fire crackers take and for those who won't make it. Tonight, Warren Robinson, 16, will be shot 20 times by police with his hands in the air. Tonight, Pedro Rios, 14, will run like a boy until the cops fire two in his back. Small armies overrun the streets, free and aimless, makeshift orchestras of whistles, bottles, bombs, the war of each day reenacted every night.
Poet Kevin Koval in studio tonight. His collection of poetry, A People's History of Chicago, out now. The artistic director of Young Chicago Authors, also the founder of Louder Than a Bomb, poetry festival, the citywide poetry festival for Chicago's youth. That poem is one that really does, we talked about sort of current events, but this is one that really sort of highlights an issue in Chicago, which is there are a lot of things happening at the same time in this town, and a lot of times not very equal.
Yeah, we live in two cities, or more at least, but we continue to reinscribe, you know, this I think terroristic inequity, this criminal inequity, in communities primarily of color, and you know, there's no difference. I mean, it seems in the eyes of many, but in reality, you know, even where we're sitting now on the Millennium Mile, you know, is so different. The Magnificent Mile, it's so different from you know, some of the spaces where the city has had this great depletion of resources, and so I think as a city. And as a person who loves the city, I want to try to account for the whole, and also, you know, bring to light constantly, as many people do, that there is this you know, giant canyon between those who have and, you know, those who are forced to live without often, and who sometimes have to turn.
And to be fair, I mean, that is where you see the inequities. You see them in history. You see them in history books and the way that we chronicle our histories. You don't hear the stories of what happens on the 4th of July or as we've seen in the last, even more than a decade, but we've seen highlighted in the news on 4th of July weekend, where there's so many shootings, so many deaths. There is a part where that will be sort of brushed over when it comes to the writing of our history now.
Yeah, we kind of perpetuate the same kind of tales and everything like that, you know, and I think, you know, one of the things that I also, you know, hope to really deal with in the book is the violence that's perpetuated by the state, you know, by the country itself in the lives of working people. I mean, you know, when we talk about violence in Chicago, it seems to be individualistic as opposed to systemic and historic. And, you know, those are the cycles that ultimately repeat from, you know, from the time that, you know, we as a city, as a country, wiped indigenous people from the land. You know, we've been stealing and taking and murdering in the name of an idea over the, you know, the lives of individuals who comprise this place. And that continues with gentrification, that continues with the erasure of you know, the work of you know, women, of the work of people of color in this city, who have championed the city, who have uplifted communities, and so we don't tell those stories. And, you know, part of what I hope the book does as well is that it you know, invites and hopes, you know, I hope to create more spaces like we do at Young Chicago Authors for people to tell those stories.
You know, as I think about this and I think about what's happening in our culture today, political culture indeed, when you think of President Trump tweeting out about Chicago, the negative reputation that the city has. I mean, as you mentioned earlier in this interview, you talked about sort of pushing back a little bit because, you know, obviously when we just heard with the Independence Day poem, there's negative attitudes in there, but I mean, or negative perceptions about who we are and what we do. But there's also a movement as part of this collection of poetry to change the sort of the national narrative of Chicago to make it more positive.
Well, and who benefits from that narrative, right? I mean, that narrative about a criminalized city it really only benefits privatized prison industrial complexes. It advocates for the, you know, continuation of a police state in certain neighborhoods and that federal response that city or county response ultimately like only, you know, plays into this also historic imagination of the, you know, the white criminalization of, you know, black and brown working people. And I think that, you know, is also, we need to counter those narratives. You know, I think that's where Donald Trump is coming from. I think too often politicians in this city are also coming from that same space. You know, I mean, it's not that. And so that's part of what this book is,
you know,
is too.
With young Chicago authors, and I want to take a break soon so we can talk more about young Chicago authors. But one of the great things about your organization, but also other organizations in town, is there seems to be much more of a collective movement to share the voices of young Chicagoans, specifically Chicagoans, young people of color. The concept that their voices count as much as others, and that may not have been the case in this city for far too long. Talk about that. I mean, that plays into this book as well, about the idea that, you know, you can be a kid from Pilsen or a kid from Inglewood and be able to write a people's history of Chicago.
Well, I think hip-hop ensures that voices who have existed at the margins of civic discourse now have carved out space for themselves at the center. I think that, you know, that's part of the process of, you know, which itself is, of course, part of the work, you know, from Ida B. Wells to now as well. You know, I mean, I think that Chicago hip hop in particular finds itself in a literary tradition of, you know, voices and workers and organizers who have really tried to ensure that the story is told in its totality and not just from the 1% or not just from the few, but from the many. And if we really believe in the principles of democracy, if we really believe in, you know, Chicago running, you know, from Howard, you know, all the way to the hundreds, then we need to hear from it. It's, you know, in its totality. And I think that's part of the reason I think young people have taken the call of hip hop cultural practice and have, you know, began to. I mean, that's why we're in the midst of a renaissance now in this city culturally, is because young people, you know, arguably probably 14 to, you know, 27, are taking the tools around them, even though the city has turned its back on them, and are creating in magnificent, profound ways. And they are, of course, in a tradition of great Chicagoans. They are in a tradition of, you know, black arts movement. They are in a tradition of, you know, Ana Castillo and Sandra Cisneros and Luis Rodriguez, and they are also in a tradition of organizers. But I think that there is a profound genius in this current generation of young people.
Let's talk about that, because, like I said, I mean, the Young Chicago Authors gets name-checked a lot on this program with some of the artists that come through here. Kevin Koval is the artistic director of Young Chicago Authors, but he's also the author of A People's History of Chicago, which is out now, Haymarket Press. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation with Kevin here on The Download. Stay with us. This is Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me at the big table tonight, poet Kevin Koval, the artistic director of Young Chicago Authors, also the founder of Louder Than a Bomb, the citywide youth poetry competition. Of course, his collection of poems, A People's History of Chicago, that's what we've been talking about. You know, I mentioned, it's amazing for all the artists that come through, poets and musicians and artists. Inevitably, we'll talk about where they came from and how they got there, and they'll talk about being in a small black box up the stairwell at Young Chicago Authors, to, you know, reading in front of their peers when they were 16 years old. I mean, it's amazing to me to think about all of the artists, from Chance the Rapper, who does the foreword for this book, and others who have gone through your doors that are now shaping American pop culture, not just Chicago pop culture, but they're sort of at the epicenter. Does that blow your mind?
Yeah, I mean, it does. I feel we're really lucky and privileged to be able to meet so many incredible young artists. I think part of what's happened is it's really simple though. In the same time, and of course, we work with organizations around the city. You know, Harold Washington Library's U Media program,
yeah, right.
Kumba Links up in Uptown, Rebirth Poetry Ensemble, Lyric in North Lawndale. There's a lot of organizations that we work with, and I think the things that we have in common is that we try to create spaces in a city that criminalizes young people the minute they walk into any institution. And I think we countered those ideas with simple principles of just taking young people where they're at and carving out and creating space for them to be themselves without apology.
Right.
And it's a simple idea that seems to be, unfortunately, you know, kind of radical. And we need more and more of these, I think, guerrilla sanctuaries around the city of Chicago.
What I always find interesting is that a kid will come in here, a kid 19, 20 years old, and they'll talk about, they didn't necessarily start off in the atypical way that you think they would. You know, you would think that a rapper would be sort of like, with 9 years old, be like, oh, I've got this innate talent, and I'm in the studio. You know, it's not like that. They talk about being introduced to the written word. Or to the spoken word in poetry, you know, before they even knew anything about hip hop, or they had no interest, or they weren't thinking about that thing. But they talk about the confidence that comes along with performing poetry in front of people, doing things at Young Chicago Authors, or like you said, the other places, Harold Washington Library. But there is something about the lyrical element of that brings in the confidence, that gives them the confidence to put their art into music or into other forms.
I say in the book that the children of Gwendolyn Brooks are rappers. And, you know, of course, the city is honoring the centennial year of Miss Brooks. And I think, you know, we teach her all the time and for years. And I think, you know, we also see ourselves in her literary tradition. And we see Miss Brooks is our matriarch in a lot of ways. And I think that is literal, that she also taught the teachers of us. She taught the teachers of a hip hop generation. You know, her students, Angela Jackson, Carolyn Rogers, Hakeem Adabudi, you know, many others, you know, they taught us, and they taught us to really, I think, fall in love with the music and language. I mean, Miss Brooks would chop up the syllables in such unique, precise ways, where she would delight in each utterance of a word that rappers do. And I think that is the lineage and the path.
Interesting,
and
yeah.
I think it's part of the reason why, you know, young rappers in Chicago are so lyrical and also are so musical, in part is because of the
poets that came before.
That legacy, yeah.
You know, and I think about the fact that we had a couple of the kids who were in Louder Than the Bomb in the citywide poetry competition in studio, and what they're performing for us is not only lyrical and not, like you said, not only musical, but it's political.
Yeah.
And it's the story of their life, and it's a story that hasn't been told. I mean, there's something about all these kids that come through Young Chicago Authors with Louder Than a Bomb. They're telling stories that just haven't been told before.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, that's very unfortunate, right? I mean, that these are lived stories in the community every day, and I think the power of hip hop is that it demands representation, and in a city, in a country that refuses to see and acknowledge people and disenfranchise vast swatches of communities, that it is a powerful tool to ensure that the presence, the voices are also existing at the center of our civic conversation.
You know, Kevin Koval's my guest in the studio. His new book of poetry, A People's History of Chicago, is out now, the foreword by Chance the Rapper. Artistic director at Young Chicago Authors, founder of Louder Than a Bomb. I've always ended the big table, especially with Chicagoans, talk about what they love about Chicago, what they don't, and things like that. And I think in your case, instead of asking you the question, maybe we can just get you to read from one of your poems, Chicago Has My Heart, which is a great poem that's in the collection. Why don't we do that to wrap up the big table tonight?
Don't ask me to leave. Don't force me to go. When the coasts call, when the rents rise, when the city I know is unrecognizable, it's mine. Not alone, not to own. Chicago has my heart. At the lake, on the train, in the first days of spring that remind us why we live here at all, have bodies, can use them outside the cold restrictions of clothing, the confines of neighborhood. Chicago has my heart. The land I'm most confident, Give me an address, I'll get us there. I know the grid. Blocks got people in these streets. Students whose family run the breakfast spot on 79th near Haki, who is still here building temples to black lives, monuments to Mama Gwendolyn. My family is here. My father, six blocks from me in Albany Park, the mayor of the city's broke dreams. He holds them in his growing belly, his breaking heart, falling asleep in front of the television, chatting through the night in his taxi. The city with money calls an Uber. He drives new residents to wherever they wish to go. Thank God for the hustle, the hustler. My father, the kindest, most incompetent businessman here. He doesn't swindle or cheat. He is honest and fair. What a sucker the city makes of sweet men. Like me, I guess. I just want justice and someone to read poems to you, Chicago. My heart is all the people who make it, who are making it, barely in the 77 hoods. I hate the viaducts, the millionaires who urban plan them from the suburbs they resurrect downtown. Chicago, you have my heart, my whole history, my people you saved seeking refuge here, tucked in apartments in Ukrainian village in North Lawndale. You saved them from history while destroying others. My mother left, my brother moved, my friends gone, too much rent, debt, you killed some off, you are a ghost mound, I stalk still. Chicago, you have my heart, split in two, like the city and stories you tell, but I am one, not two, I am one, second will not do, you can't continue to break us in two, in remade, refurbished, renewed models for the few. Chicago has my heart, but my head, my hands, my body with the people who build, who have a limit and can break and tear it down and stop it from becoming what it's becoming. What is it becoming? Chicago has my heart, but the hearts of those who call this home, who root and champion the losers and villains who run this place, who put on for the pizza in Arctic weather. We will turn our backs on the very land we are locked in, turn our backs on the capital, wage slaves you've made us become. We will burn your memory in effigy and house dance in the afterglow. We rise, Chicago. This body politic will rise. Our fire will burn again.
Wow. That's great. Poet Kevin Koval in studio, A People's History of Chicago, his new collection. Kevin, I can't thank you enough for coming in, performing as well.
Pleasure,
thanks
man.
For
thank
being my
you.
Guest.
I appreciate the conversation too, Justin. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, coming up this hour, Jordan Vogt Roberts is going to join us. He's a filmmaker. He's the director of Kong Skull Island, which made a gazillion dollars, as a King Kong movie does. But Jordan is from Chicago. He actually went to Columbia College. He had a great career in independent film. He had a hit at Sundance, and they're like, you know what? You should direct the Kong movie. So his first major studio picture was Kong Skull Island. So we'll talk to him about his career, not only in Hollywood, but here when he was here in Chicago. So that's coming up. And also, Kristen Toomey and Rena Kalm will be here to play The Worst, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. That's coming up at 10 o'clock, 312-981-7200. Well, this Friday night, the Symphony Center presents Jazz Series continues. The series is one that features icons and innovators in jazz. Friday night's going to be no exception. With an all-star lineup, jazz great Charles Lloyd brings his band The Marvels to Chicago. But the opening act is no slouch either. I'm talking about cellist, composer, and Chicagoan, Tomika Reed. That's music from the Tomika Reed Quartet, which will be on stage at the Symphony Center. Reed was named one of the Chicagoans of the Year by the Chicago Tribune back in 2015. and has played all over the world, including right here at the Chicago Jazz Festival. The Tamika Reid Quartet's debut album is self-titled. It's available for streaming. And Tamika Reid is in studio tonight. Tamika, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The Symphony Center, not a place that you automatically think of home for jazz. And they've been doing the jazz series for a while. You know, we had other musicians have been on talking about this series. What's it mean for you as a cellist to be able to play on a stage like the Chicago Symphony Orchestra?
Well, it's pretty exciting. I remember just always walking past the building for so many years. And I even worked at Symphony Center store, I think, when I first moved to Chicago.
Really?
Yeah, when I was in grad school at DePaul. So to think that I'm actually going to be performing on the stage there is pretty amazing.
You play an instrument in the cello that sort of has two lives. Mm-hmm. One that is, you know, obviously played in jazz music and quartet, also chamber music and in a symphony setting. But, mm-hmm. I mean, for you, it's not that much of a stretch to play a Symphony Center stage because, you know, you do the instrument shares mediums.
Yes, it's true. I mean, that's what I really love about the cello. It's a very versatile instrument. It can be a melody. It can play the melody. It can be the harmonic instrument. It could be a function as a bass. So, yeah, it has a lot of different roles that it can perform. So that makes it exciting to try and figure out and develop ideas.
For you as a player, and I always think about you have to, at a certain point, if you're going to take on that instrument, do you have to make a choice in which direction you want to go? I mean, you know, because a cello is used, you know, primarily. I mean, it's an instrument that's used in symphonies, you know, but it also jazz. I mean, do you have to sort of at a certain point in your musical career say, you know what, I'm a jazz cellist?
I don't know if you have to. I feel like I have because I just work more in those contexts that are more improvisational, and I really get a lot of fulfillment out of that. But it's fun because when I do go back and play some classical repertoire, I actually feel like the technique that I've amassed from playing in improvisation, I feel like I play classical music better and I feel a lot more relaxed actually because I'm just like, oh, well, maybe I missed that note, whatever. You just keep, you know, I don't have that same, feeling I think I had before when I would sometimes play some classical pieces.
Well, I think about as much as you're sharing the same stage at the Symphony Center, they couldn't be more different, you know, art forms when you think about, you know, symphony work or chamber music, classical music. You really have to hit the notes that are mm-hmm. that are in the piece of music that you're playing. In jazz music, it's an improvised art form. You're sort of like, watch me for the changes, things, you know, you're kind of going for a vibe. Mm-hmm. Is it difficult as a musician to kind of go back and forth in that kind of musical experience?
I think at first it was, but now not so much. I don't think about it as much. Again, I really do like playing in it. I love playing right notes, but it's also fun to see what develops from playing what are quote-unquote wrong notes or other notes, making other sounds. But there's a lot of beauty in playing classical music, which I still enjoy doing.
This series at the Symphony Center, brings a lot of jazz greats to the stage. You know, for you, you've played with a lot of great people. Looking at your resume, I mean, it's amazing to think that not only do you have your quartet, but as a cellist, you play on so many other artists' albums. Mm-hmm. You know, you're constantly working. Mm-hmm. For you as a musician, do you like it that way? Do you like the idea of being versatile where you can be a part of somebody's band, but at the same time have your own project?
Totally. I really enjoy being a side person. I mean, I did that for a really long time, and I like to think that being a side person has helped me to actually be a better leader because I know how that functions. I know how I'd like to be treated I feel a rehearsal should be run so I can, because I've had all these different experiences, I feel like it helps me in my band leading. So, yeah, I love playing in other people's projects. It's fun.
Tamika Reid, jazz cellist in studio with me tonight. She's going to be on stage Friday at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll continue the conversation. Tamika Reid, my guest, stay with us. There's that jazz cello we're looking for. In studio with me tonight, Tamika Reed. That's the Tamika Reed Quartet. She is going to be playing with her quartet at Symphony Center as part of the jazz series that is presented. Charles Lloyd and his band, The Marvels, will be the headliner this Friday night at the Symphony Center here on Michigan Avenue. You know, Tamika, it's interesting because I think of the cello, I think of the bass. Give us a sort of a, who do you look for or look to as someone who inspires you as a player? I mean, I think of the sort of jazz greats and I think of bass players, but as cellists, who comes to mind?
I would say first and foremost, Abdul Wadud, a great cello player, played often with Julius Hemphill, definitely comes to mind. And I would say Billy Bang, violinist, great violinist, passed a few years ago. And Leroy Jenkins. I would say those three in particular.
You know, when you think about the music, I mean, the quartet, and we just heard a sampling of it, but I mean, also your music in general, I mean, you're really pushing sort of creative boundaries with jazz. I mean, you're not playing the sort of standard stuff that that we might know, you know, from bassists and cellists of the past. Talk about that. Talk about where you want to take jazz, where you want to take the music and what you're trying to accomplish.
Well, I feel like that's something that's really unique and special to Chicago and my experience living here. Being a member of the AACM, they're always encouraging you to find your own voice, to write your own original music. It's just a big, huge part of their philosophy. And so, there are a few jazz cello players, so it's like finding your own, trying to create your own, develop your own voice on that instrument.
Is it because they're more stand-up bass? I mean, what is usually used in place of the cello?
Well, I just think nothing in place of the cello. I just think a lot of string players aren't encouraged to improvise, I feel. It's not a part of university education or even secondary education. It's like taught to get off the page, you know, you don't get a lot of experiences to do that, and so I think that's probably why there aren't as many. But I'm hoping to be kind of an advocate for that, so that other string players can feel comfortable or want to explore it, maybe, you know.
You mentioned Chicago being sort of an epicenter for creative jazz. Mm-hmm. The AACM has been around for a while now, and talk about that. Talk about what makes this city push, because when you say that to make original music or compose original music, a lot of what jazz is and what people may know it as is the standard, meaning people play the standard and maybe they put their own take on it or spin on it. But but the AACM is really pushing artists to branch out and create their own original jazz music.
I don't know. I think there's must be something in the energy in this city that just, you know, people can be here and do really creative things or feel comfortable exploring their creativity. Maybe because it's not as expensive as other cities, like maybe say New York, where you're like, oh my God, you know, you have to make a certain amount so you can afford your rent. But here it's like, it's easier economically, I think, to really feel comfortable exploring different things. And then there's just such a beautiful community of musicians here that are very supportive of each other. So you can, you know, try out all your new compositions and make crazy sounds and see what works and see what doesn't.
As a cellist, as a jazz performer, are you aware of the history of jazz in the city? I mean, is it something that sort of is taught by the elders?
I feel like the elders definitely talk about, you know, the experiences that they've had in the past and the music. And, unfortunately, some of the elders that I was around, particularly Fred Anderson, has passed, and the Velvet Lounge was a very special place where, you know, you got that education.
And that's really the idea of sitting in or the house shows or not the house show, but the jam sessions. I mean, that Velvet Room was a famous place for that. Yeah. And that how you got your start? I mean, you bring your cello down and
actually, yeah, I connected with a really great flute player by the name of Nicole Mitchell, And she would do a lot of shows at the Velvet. So I used to play there a lot, actually. I miss that space. But yeah, it was a great place because it was where you could really workshop your new ideas before you took them to a big stage like Symphony Center.
Well, I mean, you talk about the cello. I mean, was it difficult to, I guess it probably isn't when you talk about the way jazz is constructed, but I mean, you're showing up at jam sessions with a cello as opposed to a horn or, mm-hmm. or drums or, you know, or what, the other standard jazz instruments. Mm-hmm. Was it difficult to play along with what people were doing sort of in the moment?
Not necessarily. It just, you know, amplification is an issue. So for me, it was always kind of a pain because I'd have to bring an amp or whatever, or, you know, the saxophones have all those keys and they're just like, blah, 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 and you're like, I have one hand and strings. But no, it was cool. I mean, I got a lot out of going to those sessions and stuff.
You know, as you look at where jazz is at now, and you talked about the sort of the strong community, it's smaller than it has been in Chicago's history, mm-hmm. you know. Is it still a strong, vibrant community when you don't have the sort of Fred Andersons and others of the elders who are no longer with us?
Yeah,
Von Freeman's. I mean, are there other musicians that are stepping up to fill that void and continue the legacy of the Chicago jazz scene?
Yeah, I mean, there's great spaces. I mean, we have the great new venue Constellation that has a lot of, you know, creative performances there. Elastic's doing good stuff. There's lots of venues that are doing great things around the city.
Well, so. One of those venues is the Chicago Symphony Center, yes. Which will have the jazz series this Friday night. Charles Lloyd and his band, The Marvels, will be there, but also Tamika Reed and her quartet. Tamika Reed, a Chicago jazz cellist who is, along with her quartet, has played all over the world right here at the Chicago Jazz Festival, and she was named Chicagoan of the Year back in 2015 by the Chicago Tribune. Tamika, great to meet you, and good luck with the show on Friday.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my next guest is a filmmaker, screenwriter, television director in Hollywood. We've got to start right here in Chicago. Jordan Vogt Roberts is director of Kong Skull Island.
Yeah, you smell that? That's death.
What the hell is this place?
This is what's left of Kong's parents.
I've taken enough photos of mass graves to recognize one.
Crash site's just on the other side of this valley.
We'll cross through and make it to the highest point west.
This place is a real no-no, sir.
We need to be going to the north side right now.
And you're welcome to do that, my man. By yourself. Now, who's with me?
We can make it.
You're mighty right we can make it.
Now, stay sharp. Keep an eye out.
I've only been here 28 years. What do I know?
The movie bringing back the King Kong franchise has made over $500 million worldwide since its release last month. It was also the first major studio picture for Vogt Roberts, who directed the great indie film Kings of Summer, which won over audiences at Sundance, as well as TV shows like You're the Worst on FX. And as I said earlier, he spent some time here in Chicago back in the mid-2000s doing short films with the Blurds crew, the crew of stand-up comedians that featured T.J. Miller, Pete Holmes, Kyle Kinane, Kumail Nanjiani, just to name a few. Jordan Vogt Roberts currently lives in L.A., and he joins me on the phone now. Jordan, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I love anything regarding Chicago.
Well, it's amazing, and congrats on the success of the film. So let's start with Kong. I mean, I would say it's a little bit of a departure for you in your career, but the idea of doing a huge monster movie like this, what did you know about the King Kong franchise before you got involved?
Well, I mean, King Kong is a piece of pop culture and film history. You know, most people know about the icon of King Kong well before they've ever seen one of the films, much less the 1933 film, which is still a masterpiece. So I'm just a nerd who grew up on like Harryhausen films and genre cinema, and so like I grew up on sort of creature features and things like that, so I always had this like embedded love of it. But before I even discovered Kong, it was just, you know, I used to like watch movie making documentaries and like go to the local library and like nerd out on like these books where you would just look at Godzilla and Kong and like, you know, the creatures from Harryhausen's films, and just like my brain would go crazy thinking about the possibilities of it.
Well, there's so many possibilities. That's what's great, especially when you're doing a reboot. How tight-lipped or how tight-vested were the producers and Legendary and everybody else about what you could do with the Kong character and the franchise? I mean, did they let you let King Kong fly? Would you let him put King Kong in a dress? Like, what would they let you do and or not do to such an iconic character?
You know, there's a lot of crazy things that happen in Hollywood, and I'm going to say that putting him in a dress or having him fly were never things that were brought up. But, you know, honestly, when they came to me, it sort of was a really interesting conversation because they came to me and they had a script that took place in 1917, and my initial reaction was, cool, like, I love King Kong, and I love the fact that you guys want to make a new movie, but audiences are smart now. Right? They've always been smart. So why does this movie need to exist? What makes it special? What makes it different? And that's when I sort of pitched them an idea that I thought was insane, that they were going to laugh me out of the room on, when I was like, I want to make like Apocalypse Now in King Kong. I want to make a right. Vietnam War movie right. like Platoon mixed with like a creature feature, because I was like, I've never seen that. You know, like when I went to the movies as a kid, I was just bombarded with worlds and ideas and things I'd never seen before. And now you kind of are fed the same things over and over again, so it doesn't feel as special. So, you know, that from the get-go of saying, look, we're not doing a reboot necessarily. We're not remaking. My big thing was Peter Jackson nailed his remake for what it is. I had zero interest in telling the Beauty and the Beast story and telling the story of taking Kong and the Empire State Building and all of that. It was like, let's tell a new story. Let's make good on all these crazy sort of genre ideas that can exist within this world and really lean into like Japanese kaiju films and things like that and go off the deep end with it. So like the movie, what I'm really proud of is, I think there are a lot of people who rightfully so would be really skeptical of why they would just see a new King Kong movie. And then pretty universally, people walk out of the film and they're like, whoa, that is not what I expected. And I'm really proud of that.
Is there pressure on you when you're in the pitch meeting and said, what if we do this a little bit more apocalypse style now, 1970s period piece? And they're like, sold. Do it, Jordan. The idea of doing such a huge monster pick with a period attached to it, you know, in shooting in Vietnam. Talk about that. I mean, was there some pressure? What was the stress factor in creating such a huge King Kong picture?
Well, look, you're playing with film history. You're playing with an icon of cinema. So that in itself is an incredibly nerve-wracking thing. Then you're dealing with the fact that you're making a giant studio movie for hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's its own set of pressure. And making a movie in general is one of the hardest things you can ever do. And so there's an enormous amount of pressure. But honestly, like I said, when I pitched them that idea, I thought they were going to laugh me out of the room. And so when they said, actually, that's a really cool idea, let's do that, you kind of have this response of like, oh, crap. Now I have to figure out how we actually do this. Because when you first pitch it, it's in very vague terms aesthetics. And, it, you know, to me, it was just like this idea of like choppers and napalm and Hendrix and monsters, you know. And I was like, I've never seen that. And then to take you that and turn it into like a fully fleshed out, living, breathing film is a very different thing.
Well, I mean, you had success with Kings of Summer, and that was did great at Sundance and was released. But talk about, you know, how you mentally prepare to do a picture of this size. I mean, because we all know about filmmaking. We've seen the same sort of documentaries behind the scenes. But you as a filmmaker, especially a first-time major motion picture filmmaker, what do you have to do to mentally prepare for the approach?
Chain smoke. No, you know, it's really interesting because on one hand, I think filmmaking, to some degree, is filmmaking. You still have to, like, fundamentally tell a story and invest people and, you know, constantly ask the same questions of how you improve and make something better and how you engage audiences. And then, yeah, it's much different. It's a hugely different, you know, beast when you're dealing with that much money and the visual effects and all of that. But, like, if you learn how to drive a car, you get a license, right? So you could get in a truck. You could probably figure out a stick shift. You could get in a race car, too. That doesn't mean you're not going to crash your race car into a wall. But, you know, the fundamentals are essentially the same. So it's interesting how similar and how different they are at the same time. But, like, with filmmaking, you never have enough light. You never have enough money. You never have enough time, no matter what. Those are, like, the core essentials of it. And so then you really just try and hunker down and, like, you just try and find your, like, your focus. And you just have to learn to continue to trust your gut. You got to a certain place for a reason, and so you're like, this is what I'm fighting for.
You know, when you talk about movies of this size, when you're talking about millions and millions of dollar budget films, and you talk to directors, you always hear them saying that it almost becomes more of, like, you become a man manager on the set. I mean, there's so much that you have that has to go a certain way, and it's almost a small business that's happening when you're shooting this film over a course of a couple months. Do you feel that way? I mean, having this experience with so many employees that work for you?
I think it can very easily become that, and I think that there are a lot of very modern examples of directors who sort of enter a big studio film where they're like this sort of cog, and then a bunch of things happen around them. I'm just a very hands-on and stubborn person where, and I was very upfront about this, where it was important for me to try and bring as much of the ethos of how you make an independent film and bring it into this. You know, there's actually a lot, like a lot of the stuff with John C. Reilly in this film, like a lot of that is improvised. A lot of that is us like being loose and being spontaneous and finding the spark and finding the moments. And, you know, people have this conception of visual effects stuff where like it's very sort of set in its way. And it's locked before you do it. And we tried to stay as fluid as possible. And so then, you know, I think the bad version is actually a little bit of what you described, where it is just this managerial task. Mm-hmm. For me, I wanted it to be this thing where you are on the ground every day and things are changing and you're rolling with the punches and you're doing this and you're trying to make something that has life to it, has a soul to it, you know? And so at times it was sort of a weird sort of stretch where like the studio system, I don't think was ever fully going to conform to me and I was never fully going to conform to it. And I think that the movie works because it is kind of a happy medium of something that feels like it has a spark and a soul. Yet it also is this big sort of accessible blockbuster.
Jordan Vogt Roberts is the director of Kong Skull Island. You know, I read somewhere that there's a setup with Legendary and even moving it over to continuing to go. There's going to be a Godzilla King Kong pick in the future here. But you are more interested, like you talked about, I'd love to do an indie film about the character Marlowe and what happened between, you know, in at the beginning, we don't see before the movie starts. There is something about the storyline and the story that you're more interested in than, you know, taking on the next big monster picture.
Yeah, well, look, my career has just been jumping around in general, going from like weird little shorts in Chicago where I was like practically flunking out of Columbia because I was making shorts with a bunch of comedians to doing TV shows and making these weird jumps and doing indies and going to a big feature. And so I just always want to do different things. I never want to feel like I'm doing the same thing over and over again. You know, I am more interested in that, like, that human component. I'm really proud of this movie. I'm proud of how weird it is. I'm proud of the fact that I feel like people walk out of it and they're like, oh, man, that's the movie I wanted to see when I was 12. You know, or like,
right.
I felt like a little kid again, you know, and you feel transported. And so I'm so proud of those things, but it's a huge undertaking, you know. So for me, it's less about my, like, natural interest in like the shared universe or the franchise as much as it is just, you know, this has been 2.5 years of my life, so you know, whatever I do next, I want it to be something a bit more controllable and contained.
Well, for you, I mean, you mentioned Chicago, Columbia College, also working with Blurreds and doing short films. From your time in Chicago, and talk about, you know, what you learned as a filmmaker that you take with you, that stays with you when you're on a set directing something like Kong.
Honestly, it's almost the same thing. So those things when I was in Chicago, when like Thomas Middleditch or, you know, me and Kumail or Kyle Kinane or Matt Bronger or whomever, when we would just go out in the middle of the night and shoot some short film or make something, that you know, I was doing all that stuff myself back then. I was shooting it, I was editing it, I was mixing it, I was coloring it, I was production designing it. Like, I was this, like, one-man wrecking crew. I was, like, this lone wolf with a bunch of comedians who were, like, you know, 7, 10 years older than me, you know? And so I was just this, like, one-man band who would go and do all of this stuff. And that was super helpful because I think that still has continued in my work today where I'm just very hands-on in every department because I used to do everything. And specifically, like, I could have never really known this to be the case at the time, but because of Second City, because of I.O., because of just the way the sort of comedy scene is set up there, like, improv as a whole has become such a huge component of the way in which I work and the style in which I direct. You know, where I think it's just a life skill that teaches you to sort of fail boldly and to fail bravely. And those sort of things that I picked up in Chicago, working with comedians, working with improvisers, that has very much become embedded in my style of directing.
It's really great as someone who was a fan of Blurreds back in 2007, 2006, 2000, right in that area, to watch all of the great comedians and yourself have successful careers in Hollywood. How important is it for you guys to continue those relationships? You know, obviously you move out into different areas, in New York, L.A., or you're in different movies. Now you guys are at the point where you could see each other working together on big projects for different places. Is it important for you to think about those relationships you carved out in Chicago?
Well, it's funny because I remember at the time, like, all my friends kind of thought I was crazy. They're like, wait, you're just going and you're shooting these videos for free? What are you doing? And I was like, I think there's something special going on here, because it really was so crazy to me at the time. You know, it wasn't people trying to get famous necessarily. There was like one or two that were like chasing that. But for the most part, because of the way Chicago is set up, it was just about people cutting their teeth for the love of the craft, for the love of comedy and their passion for what it is, as opposed to like, I wonder which manager's in the audience. I wonder which executive is here. Like, yeah, what's right, about right. that? It was just people being funny, and it was so much a part of the lifestyle of going to shows and drinking and going to multiple shows a night and just making things. And so at the time, like, I looked around and I was like, this is such an incredible pool of talent. And I was kind of the one saying, guys, we should shoot some stuff. You know, they weren't really making videos at the time, because this is all like very early days of YouTube, where that stuff, no one was like making money off of that. No one was monetizing it. So they were just like going to shows and doing stand up. And I was like, guys, let's make some shorts, do some stuff. And you know, you always thought that all of those people were super talented, but the degree to which you look at a Silicon Valley, you know, with Thomas and Kumail and the other people from Chicago, and then you look at what Hannibal Buress is off doing and Pete Holmes and Matt Bronger and Kyle Kinane being the voice of Comedy Central. And like, on one hand, you sort of sit there and you say, I could have told you that. Like, these guys were so talented back in the day, it oozed out of them. On the other hand, you have to pinch yourself. And there are times when we run into each other and we all look around and, you know, we were all struggling. We couldn't pay our rent. You know, it was like, who's buying drinks tonight? And so watching the trajectory of everyone sort of gain success on their own terms has been amazing. You know, and like when I did Kings of Summer, just being able to call up Middle Ditch or call up a Hannibal or, you know, call up these guys and be like, hey, I need you to fly in for a day. It's a super small part. Just come and do this thing. And then for them to be able to do it, which they have no right doing because of how amazing they are, it makes such a huge difference. And, you know, some of those people are still like my dear friends, but it's mainly just amazing watching such a group of people all kind of go off on their own thing. And there was a point when everyone sort of split off. Half the people went to New York, half the people went to LA. Everyone was doing their own thing. Everyone was popping at different times, and some people were still struggling and some people still are, but you know, there's just it was such a special time and a special group that I just, you know, in my life, I don't think will ever be recreated.
Yeah. Well, we continue to watch with excitement to watch the trajectory of your career and the career of the others that were in Blur. It's Jordan Vogt Roberts is my guest tonight. He's the director of Kong Skull Island, which has made over $500 million worldwide. Jordan, can't thank you enough for taking some time out, and congrats on your success.
Thank you so much, man. It really means a lot. And I really just cherish all of that time that I spent in Chicago, be it drinking or eating or whatever. It's just such a special place. And so to see all of those people kind of, like I said, doing what they're doing is honestly kind of shocking and amazing and wonderful.
All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN, and it's Tuesday night, so that means it's time to play the worst. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can text, you can call in, tell us what's the worst. We complain about the worst things in society for prizes. We got good prizes tonight. Unique prizes. I always like, there's always a gift certificate for Lou Malnati's, but we've got a pair of tickets to see Mary Poppins. No big deal. And a package for four at the Hawthorne Racecourse for the 59th Illinois Derby. A race. Horse racing. It's pretty
Love
cool.
Love horse
right?
racing.
That's a cool thing. All right. So we got some great comics in studio tonight. Rena Kalm. Rena,
hello.
Good to see you.
You too.
You can see Rena Top 10 Tuesdays at the Laugh Factory every Tuesday night at 9:30. Also in studio tonight, Tim McLaughlin.
Hello.
Tim, how are you? Good to see you. He is part of the Blind Bet Show at the Pony Inn, Wednesday nights, 9 o'clock, Roscoe Village. It's like Belmont Palina.
Yep.
Tim, good to see you. All right, so we, you know the rules of this game, 312-981-7200. Just text in or call in and tell us what's the worst. It's a simple, very simple game. And we will start, as we do every Tuesday night, with my man Pete Zimmerman. He kicks it off with the worst. Pete, what do you got tonight?
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
Vague Facebook posts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Why do I... Don't make me fish or read comments. Just tell me what the problem is.
I had one the other day. Someone said something like, I'm not going to tell you what's up, but pretty soon you'll know what's going on.
Wait, now do you mean like vague as in like the topic is vague, or like vague booking, which is very different? Vague booking is when you say something about somebody specific, but you make vague.
Right. I like that, though, because then I can try to figure out who it is.
Oh,
like,
totally. That's more fun.
I'm pretty good at it. I'll just send a message and I'm just like, Dan, Tom, Mike. And they're like, yep, Mike.
Mike, you got it. You got it on the third try.
Got it.
Tim loves gossip. That's
I love
sure.
it.
And it's also the mystery of it. You love the mystery. You're like a CSI Facebook guy, right?
But whenever someone's like, you can't even believe the day I've had and the things I've got coming up, I'm like, okay, attention. You just want attention.
Right.
Yeah, and also, I mean, maybe not as much for me right now as Facebook posts, but messages for like people asking me to do stuff without all the information I need.
Oh, yeah.
And when it's anything vague, like, tell me everything. Right. Tell me the day, the time, what to wear. Tell me as much as possible.
Would you be willing to go an hour and 15 minutes for a show?
But also, like, keep it quick. I don't have time to read the whole message, you know, abbreviate.
And then you get there and they're like, this show is actually for dogs. And you're going to have to feed them treats out of your mouth. We're giving you $15. So
yeah, that's the worst.
All right, that does sound like the worst. Sounds like you guys have it bad, comics on Facebook. All right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Rena, why don't we start with you tonight? What's the worst?
Oh, man. You know, lately I've been trying to date a little bit, so everything associated with that seems like the worst. But specifically, like, opening messages on, like, any of these apps, on Tinder or whatever.
When you say, like, opening messages.
Yeah, like, I know, like, there's that one. Yeah, like, even that I feel like is okay. I mean, it's boring and I won't write back, but, like, no. Oh, man.
Hey was my go-to.
That's...
Because everything else, they were like, ugh.
Yeah.
So are you talking about, like, most of the opening messages are they're not creative enough and they're gross, or what's the
be like, hey, let's chat. Do you want to chat? Instead of like, let me tell you something interesting. And it's like, usually it's not. Usually it is very much not. And I mean, it's a superficial dating website anyway. So it's like, I already said yes to your face. Like, just, I don't know, make a noise with it. Or, I don't know, just give me the information. Right, right. Tell me when. Tell me where.
You're really into abbreviated information. You want it right in front of you. All right. Okay. Good to know.
I'd like to chat at 9 p.m. at Starbucks. Please wear a red dress and I will know it's
you. How much? Right.
And then Rena's $15. Like, perfect.
Right. All right. There you go. Tim, what do you got for the worst?
The worst to me is people crossing the street when the light for them is red and they're just still going because they think that Chicago has traffic laws where it's like, well, I'm a pedestrian, I can still cross when it's red.
I'm with you.
I will kill you with my car. I will kill you. I almost murdered a guy the other day and my girlfriend was like, Tim, you can't hit him. And I was like, I'll murder him.
I'm in the right of way. There's a certain point where you're like, you know what? Yes, there will be a trial. There'll be a lot that goes into it. But at the end of the day, I'm in the right of way.
And the thing is, I'll get sent for manslaughter or whatever because they'll be like, you're showing no remorse. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I told him he'd die. I get so mad.
You know, what gets me is the, I was just complaining about this the other day, you're downtown in the morning rush hour, when someone decides to change the pace of their walk to like a jog or slower, and it throws off the timing of everybody.
Yeah.
So if you're like with 8 seconds left on that clock and they're like, they put a little jog into it and you're like, wait, you're jogging in front of, now there's no, you know what?
Sidewalks, I drive all the time now, just like Tim. So, like, I think I take that for granted how much that used to bother me. But my pet peeve is, like, people who walk in pairs, not necessarily during rush hour, but even just
in general.
For me, rush hour is going to a show at night. You guys are having a nice dinner. You're walking down the sidewalk, holding hands into go bags. And it's like, this is a busy sidewalk.
Oh, yeah, take it up the sidewalk. Quit taking up the sidewalk.
Why don't you walk like I file my taxes? Single file, baby.
I was walking with my girlfriend single file today on the trail because I'm like, there's going to be people coming up because I think of other people and I'm not having a nice time holding someone's hand.
You're considerate like that.
No, just go home and hold hands. We don't need to see that.
Hold hands in the privacy of your own homes.
Listen, I don't want to sound like a 1950s preacher, but we don't need anybody holding hands out here.
No holding hands. There you go. The worst, holding hands. 312-981-7200. We got Pete on the line. Got some great texts that are coming in. Let's take a quick break to stay on time tonight. We'll come back more with the worst. Stay with us.
It's going down, y'all.
Playing the worst here, 312-981-7200. We're complaining about the worst things in society for prizes. Rena Kallman studio, as well as Tim McLaughlin. And we'll get to all your promo stuff in just a second. Let's get to the phones because we've already got people waiting here. Let's go to Pete. Pete, what's the worst, Pete?
Hi, how you doing tonight? I will tell you the worst. I'm like 59, but I'm not like an old guy at 59. I'm one of those like energetic guys. I spent 24 years in the Navy. But you go apply for a job somewhere part-time, you're going to work in a restaurant or apply. And you go, oh, you're overqualified because you can't do this and you can't do that because we think you're better at this. So
when people say you're overqualified, that is the worst. Like if you're applying for a job and they're like, I'd love to give it to you, but you're just overqualified.
That's what they said when I went to Hooters.
Oh, Marina.
Yeah.
I'd hire you anytime.
But you get a little smarter, you want a mentor, you want all these new words that they throw in there for their corporate world. And I'm all set to do that, but oh no, they just think I'm just a little tad overqualified and I wouldn't accept that job, you know?
You've been successful in your life. Too successful, Pete. That's the problem. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. All right, let's go to Kenny. Kenny, what's the worst, Kenny?
Okay, we get these calls at the house because we have a foreign last name. And they'll say they're from IRS or immigration.
Yeah.
There's a big problem, and we're going to have to give them a lot of money to try to scare us to fix the problem.
And you give it to them, right?
Oh, no. Actually, what I did, I memorized Bill Cosby's information. And so they'll ask, what's your birthday? I'm like, July 12th, 1937. Where were you born? I was born in Philadelphia. And I go on sometime, and then eventually I turn into Cosby and go, you see, it is yellow. That's when they hang up.
They have no idea what's going on. That's brilliant, Kenny.
That's amazing. That's the best.
That is the best. You may have just won the race. Kenny, thanks, buddy.
That's really good.
That was good, right?
I would hire him to answer phones at my house, but he sounds overqualified, so I don't know. That guy sounded overqualified for Jack Daniels. Now, I don't know if that's a nice thing to say, but I don't care.
312-981-7200. 773 says, you know what's the worst? Making a brownie mix. Baking the frosting packet instead of the brownie part.
Being high?
Sounds like, what kind of brownies are you making?
Oh, it's the worst when I try to make brownies, I mess it all up.
There isn't usually frosting.
Yeah. That's after the fact, right?
No,
some of them have that now. My grandma makes ones with frosting.
Okay.
They said they discovered this after the brownies didn't rise.
I don't know how much frosting they give you, but maybe lay off the pot.
First of all, the brownies don't really rise.
Yeah, right.
Not a lot. They're fudgy.
They kind of just hang in there.
Yeah, unless you use the egg white recipe, then okay, now we're getting detailed.
It's all right. Keep going. 773 says, the worst is when people can't choose their own lane when walking and they make you do a weird zigzag around them. We kind of went over
that. Yeah, and they're right. And you know what? Give them the prize because they agreed with
me
earlier.
It's a power move.
I want them to have the prize.
The game's over, right?
I mean, I texted. I texted that because I really want that pizza. But
where can I text that Tim McLaughlin is the worst?
312-981-7200. All right, 773 says taking your kids to an Easter egg hunt on the wrong day, finding yourself and the kids at an empty park. Oh man!
What is everyone high?
That guy needs to,
that's a lot of right. Then they go back and make some brownies.
Yeah, they looked around the park. All they found were these deflated brownies.
And... I used to be the Easter Bunny. That was my job.
Are you Sean Spicer?
Really?
Yeah, for my cousin, I was the Easter Bunny, and this was real bad because the kids got older. I did it for like 5 years. And then the kids got older. My cousin goes, it's you. And I was like, it's not. That's the real Easter Bunny. She goes, no. Easter bunnies don't wear shoes, and you have the same shoes as the Easter Bunny, so you're the Easter Bunny. And I was like, go away or I'm going to steal your candy. Yeah. That's what I said, if you tell any of the other kids, I'm going to steal all of your candy and eat it in front of you. And my uncle goes, you can't say that to my daughter. And I go, well, do you want her to tell the other kids? Yeah. And he was like,
I'm just trying to, there's a problem in front of me, I'm trying to solve it.
Yeah, creative solutions, you know?
And then all right, here.
Now I'm not allowed to see him anymore.
Just ruin one childhood. You know what I mean?
This one might be a really front runner. Okay. Ooh. Coming in from 630. It was very simple. The worst is getting attacked by a goose
that you didn't provoke?
Oh, yeah. Been there. Been there, my friend.
Never been there. Been there. My mom always said, stay far away from the geese because a bunch of them bit me one time.
Yeah.
And I've provoked.
You've provoked a goose?
Well, there was one goose, a pet goose, in the neighborhood. And yeah, he was mean. Yeah. So like, but you know, you're talking 9, 10, or 11 years old, and you'd be like, let's see what happens when you put a stick near his face and see what happens. Then they get mad, and you're like, ah, and everyone runs. So I understand the idea of provocation, but yeah, it is the worst.
Oh, I had a different approach. Yeah. I was like one of those gals that was like, oh, I'll like speak to the animals, like, you know, get them to clean my house like Snow White or whatever, you know? Or make a dress like Cinderella, and then the thing bit me anyway. So I hate all animals now. Okay, just kidding. But
we used to have swans. I used to live on a lake when I was like 21, and we had swans on the lake that they just added there because it was just like a little tiny lake that you could only have pontoons on. Mm. And they would come up to the pontoon and just bang their head on it like trying to get at us. And I was like, get out of here, swans.
That's not graceful.
Yeah.
It's ungraceful.
Liars is what swans are, if you think about it.
I hate them.
All right. There's some good stuff here. Let's get to, where did Mary? Mary 630 says, bowling next week, which is the last week, against a team you bowled the very first night the league started, and they were crabby and not friendly.
Well, yeah, that sounds pretty bad.
So you're not looking forward to it again.
Yeah, that's the worst. But also, did you win or did you lose? Because you got to know that, because if you won, it's double worse because you don't like to play a team you beat before twice. And then secondly, if they're jerks, you don't want to play them again because they're big dumb jerks. Also, who goes to bowling and is a jerk?
Yeah, who has no personality or is not fun to bowl
with? Who's got the time to go, oh, I hate bowling. I hate that I'm here. This is court mandated.
I was in a media league one time, and I remember there being sort of like a rivalry. It was getting close, like, you know, it's sort of like the end of the game or whatever.
Yeah.
And the last guy, Jack, and this I'll never forget this. I mean, we were just kind of joking around. Everyone was razzing. He's the last bowler on the other squad, and if he gets a strike, they win, right? He bowls the ball, turns around before the strike, and blows our team a kiss. Like Lebowski style, like sort of like, and he gets the strike. But
I love
it. But yeah, exactly. And we're like, it was the best response. It was like, what did you just do? It's so weird. Like, I don't know if we're at that level. Like, this isn't like intense.
You know what I saw one time? This is for sure the worst thing. It didn't happen to me, but I saw it happen. Me and my friend were bowling, and this guy, we were looking over because he had pulled a strike and then another strike, and he was on like the seventh, whatever it is, frame, and he had all strikes. So me and my buddy just stopped and just kind of stood far away enough so we didn't know we were watching him. Got to the 10th frame, strike, last part of the 10th frame, 9.
Ugh.
And my friend and I immediately just went back to what we were doing because I was like, this guy is going to murder
someone.
If he
sees you guys.
He got a 299. That's the worst thing ever.
That's the worst.
Oh, man. So close, so far.
Yeah. I saw a guy. I would like that pizza, please. I saw a guy get a 299. It's crazy.
That's crazy. Nuts.
312 has got a crazy one. The worst is when you host Easter and your grandmother falls off the porch.
Oh, my God.
Because she had one too many mimosas. She proceeds to land on your car, and she cracks the taillight.
Whoa.
Grandma's fine, by the way. He puts that in there, Grandma.
Oh, that's good.
That seems like a good time turned really bad. I had a story like that this last weekend. Pranks can be dangerous.
This is a Grandma mimosa story?
No,
or just
not Easter. Yeah. I'm Jewish, but so that's the worst.
No, Passover.
I had a good Passover, but no, we were staying with some friends this week, and we tried to like prank one of them with some fake bugs and like tried to do just a fun prank and scare her with fake bugs. We acted too well because she was so scared she fell and might have torn her ACL. Oh, my God.
Just won tickets to the Illinois Derby on that one. Wow. Tearing ACLs off of bug pranks.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, it was harsh.
312-981-7200. We're playing the worst tonight. Rena Kalm and Tim McLaughlin. Rena, you can see at Top 10 Tuesdays at the Laugh Factory here in town at 9:30. Tim McLaughlin, Blind Bet at the Pony Inn, Wednesday nights, 9 o'clock. That's in Roscoe Village. We'll take a break, get an update on tonight's news with Rob Martier, and we'll come back. We'll continue. We've got a lot of texts coming in. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's the worst here on the download. 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. Rena Kalm, Tim McLaughlin in studio. Rena can be seen on Top 10 Tuesdays at the Laugh Factory every Tuesday night, 9:30, which was an hour ago.
Yep. It wasn't this week. We had a special event, but every other Tuesday, 9:30 at the Laugh Factory.
There you go. Tim McLaughlin is the. Do you host it, or you just what is it? The Blind Bet.
It's a comedy showcase at the Pony Inn, and we get the best comedians. I host one week. Jonah Jerkins hosts another week. Mike Bobrinskoy hosts, but we all work together to make it one of the best shows in
there
the city.
You go. That's Wednesday nights, 9 o'clock, in Roscoe Village Pony Inn. Two great stand-ups in studio tonight helping us with the worst. People calling in 312-981-7200. We're complaining about the worst things in society for prizes. We got prizes.
Ooh.
We've got some front runners. There's some good stuff that's already come out. So let's get to some of the texts that are coming in because they're coming in fast and furious tonight. all right. Should I skip the prostate exam? Worst? Like it's the first one that popped in my eyesight. I'm like, the worst is...
You know who would be the worst?
So bad.
Is somebody going, that prostate exam was the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The worst are my doctor's same words to me before every yearly prostate exam. You're going to feel some pressure down there. Relax. Don't move. Here's some tissues if you need them. If I need them?
Whoa. What?
That's a prostate exam, I guess.
Okay. I guess I don't really know a lot
about
the
topic. How big
are
these guys' fingers? Tissues?
I guess there's for welling, for
tears?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
I think I just already pushed it out the front.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's what I was thinking, but I didn't know if I could.
I'm only 30. I've never had a prostate.
I didn't know if you could say front on the radio.
Yeah. Gonna have to hit the old delay on that one, right?
Sorry.
773, the worst, getting blinded by the intense lighting in every store. I don't know. This store's lighting is fine.
No, yeah. It's, but I get it because sometimes you maybe take a couple of funguses and then you go to buy groceries and then you're like, oh, I can't be in this grocery store right now. These lights are terrible. Now, I can get it if that's what was happening, but I think if you're just a candle person, get over yourself.
At this point, as it's the third one, I think it's a bold assumption to say that like all the people that are messaging these things are just having bad reactions to narcotics. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
It's been a real theme tonight.
Yeah.
It does. It does pick up steam. We have a lot of themes that come through.
Oh, that ain't so bad. You're high.
Yeah. That's really the theme tonight. 312, what's the worst Adam Sandler movies?
Depends which one.
Yeah, there you go. I'll stand by Wedding Singer.
Oh,
Wedding
Singer.
Only one I'll stand by.
I tried to watch it last night.
Was it? Did you try? Did you just?
Well, no one else wanted to watch it, so we watched Under Siege. But it was.
I don't understand that at all.
I love the compare, like the one side of the room Under Siege, the other room.
Well, I was just like singer. I was pro Under Siege, but I was pushing the Wedding Singer. Yeah. But everybody else wanted to watch Under Siege because Under Siege had boobs in it and people getting stabbed, and I was like, that does sound pretty sweet. So.
It is one of the better Steven Seagal movies.
It's great.
Under Siege.
Never seen it.
It's great, Reno.
Steven Seagal is.
Yeah.
Under Siege.
I mean, I know it. I know the movie. I won't see
Tommy
it.
Tommy Lee Jones? Gary right. Busey?
We were talking about Adam Sandler. I will say, yeah, like Zohan, the worst.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
That movie is a tour de force in stereotypes and strange comedy. And there's something about it because it takes place in a hair salon. I just saw it on Comedy Central where I was like, this is interesting.
I'm surprised you guys are talking about this because you're not really supposed to mess with that guy. So,
true. Hey, we already said we liked Wedding Singer.
I never saw Zohan. Oh, Click was bad.
You know what? My
That's
favorite.
All we're gonna do the worst.
Click was a bad one.
They're probably not two of his better movies. I don't remember which one it is. It's either Spanglish or Punch Drunk Love, but Cloris Leachman is like the mom in it. And the best line from that movie is like, I wouldn't have seen it without the subtitles. She's drunk and she's going upstairs and she stumbles. And on the subtitles, it says she goes, nobody noticed. And that's the best. Don't remember the movie.
I would say the one where he's Satan's son. Is
oh
the
yeah,
one.
Little Nicky.
No,
Nicky,
you guys are wrong.
Okay,
you guys are wrong. Love that movie. You guys are.
All right, let's move on from Adam.
Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore.
Love Little Nicky.
Tollbooth Willie. Come on, let's talk about the albums. Okay, let's move on.
815 said, "Oh my God, you guys, tissues are for a different reason: involuntary reactions in men."
That's true. Yeah.
So tissues, you were kind of right with the idea
front.
If you can't say front on the radio.
Yeah.
I was talking about the face. I was talking about stuff coming out of the person's
like coming
face.
Out of nose or something like that.
Yeah.
Right? All right, let's move on. I got an idea. Let's move
on.
Out move on from prostate exams and Adam Sandler movies. We'll move on from those two
things. Is there a difference?
Yeah, right.
Rena.
Let's see, 7:17. The worst is when you wait a minute for that one lady to get off her phone, only to see someone in front of what you need. This is all store related. This is someone who's in front of the store. The worst is plain-looking jumpers in the basics section that have loads of metal studs on them in really random places.
I mean, go to a different store. I feel like I don't know
what that means.
7:73. Being a nanny on the North Shore.
I mean,
I guess.
It depends on the family. She's probably right, though. They're probably the worst.
Yeah. Is it bad being in a very nice place, eating their food?
Yeah, right. Eating some mom's lounging. Cheese.
I mean, I get it.
There's driveways.
The kids never heard the word no, but you're in a nice house. You can play pretend for a little bit and then go home to your crap hole. You know, I'm not... I live in a closet, so I've got nowhere... So,
7:73, going on a dating service and being fixed up with your ex-husband.
Ouch.
Yeah.
That's
not real.
That can't be real. It could. I bet it is real. I bet it's happened once, but not to this person.
Right.
I bet they saw it on the internet and they were like, that sounds like a good one. And then they texted it.
They saw it in an Adam Sandler movie.
The worst is someone seeing a thing on the internet and being like, this happened to me, and texting it in.
I mean, if I saw my ex and...
Tim, you're really getting into it, man. You're raging out here. I like it. I have
rage problems. I really get mad at everything.
It's good for the radio. It's good for the worst. I like it.
Worst thing getting matched with your ex on a dating service would probably be just the way I get drunk and go visit the bar where my ex works. I mean, that is worse.
That's too much.
That's called the... too much. That's called the Rena Qualm J-Swipe dating service.
Oh, man.
All right, let's keep going. 7:08, Shannon says the worst is sweaty, overripe bananas.
What? But sweaty?
Ooh, yeah. Mm.
I mean, that might be an issue with how you're keeping them. And
I guess if they get overripe. I mean,
that's when you make banana bread. I'll say this, I only like bananas when they're a little green. Can we talk about it? Nobody's talking about
Nobody's
it.
Nobody's ever talking
I don't like
about
bananas
it.
At all.
Okay.
You know what's the worst? Bananas, in general.
Wow.
I hate them, and I love Little Nicky.
6:30 says the worst is being a teacher with parents of students who misbehave and the parents blame it on other students instead of their child. Well, that's specific, yeah.
Hello. Yeah, I mean, that's just an accountability issue. Nobody wants to take accountability these days.
All right, here comes some winners. Thank you, yeah. Here comes some winners.
Thank
you guys
you,
ready?
Rena.
These are the ones that I think are going to have a chance here for the prizes. 6:30 says the worst, people who walk into a tax office at 8:30 on the last day, say they have a simple return, but it's not. They've lived in two states. They took money from retirement fund, kids in daycare, etc. Ooh, etc. Then they walk out after the return is completed because they don't like the fees.
Love them.
That's what
those same people don't tip. They can take tipping off of a write-off. I'll tell you that right now. That is oh my God. If I was that person and they were walking out, I would punch both of them in the back of the head. You don't see gender then. There's no gender. You're just allowed to punch whoever you want. If anyone does that, you're allowed to punch
them.
Yeah, I mean, taxes aren't fun for anybody. Why are you going to make it worse for anybody? You know, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I feel bad. I think the worst is that they still have a dude standing out on the sidewalk in a dress from January to April in a Statue of Liberty dress. Right. Is it even for Liberty Tax Services? It's for like any of them. It's
just taxes.
Taxes
just...
are depressing enough. I don't want to be reminded that this guy can't feed his kids. You know what I'm saying? Okay, that's dark. But
that guy's getting a return, though.
Couldn't you just put up a sign?
Well, doesn't he hold a sign?
Yeah, but like, does he have to hold the sign? Couldn't they just like put it up?
Hey, man.
You know, I guess
whatever works. It worked one time. Yeah, but those people, flux of business. They're like, put Rodney back out there, man.
Yeah,
but I think they're like, hey, they'll notice that we're doing well because we have enough money to have a real person out there holding a sign instead of just.
It's all perception.
Yeah,
it's all imaging.
I don't know if anyone thinks that. I just made that up.
I wonder if they do. No,
7:08 says, you know what's the worst? Lighting your fireplace on the first cold night of the year and then awakening to a dormant yellow jacket nest in the chimney.
Yeah, yeah, that's terrifying.
I mean, I want to know more about this guy, and I want to know, or lady.
Did the yellow jackets come out?
Yeah, I would say if that was happening, maybe the worst is when your house fills up with bees. I don't think.
I don't like this. I'm terrified of bees and yellow jackets. I'm scared of all of it. And oh man, I'm not gonna sleep. I'm gonna be at my house.
You're really taking this one personally.
Like I saw the Wicker Man, and I was like, no, thank you. I just saw that bee part, and I got out of there.
Well, now I think the worst is that Tim's not going to be able to sleep for a week. You know,
that's... Yeah. I hate bees so much. It's getting warm. I like when it's cold. There's no bees.
Yeah, they're coming out now. 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll wrap up and give away the prizes for this week's The Worst. Stay with us.
It's going down,
Playing The Worst here, 312-981-7200. Justin Kaufman, The Download, 720 WGN. Rena Kalm and Tim McLaughlin in studio, two stand-up comedians here in Chicago. Rena can be seen Top 10 Tuesdays at the Laugh Factory, 9:30. Tim can be seen at Blind Bet at the Pony Inn in Roscoe Village, Wednesday nights, 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Let's get through these. You know what's the worst? 312 says the worst is pinching.
Yeah. Pinching stinks. My girlfriend pinches me, and then she tickles me, and I hate both of them, but I think I hate pinching a little bit more.
I had a roommate that would pinch me, like, just to get my attention if I was on the phone, and I'd get so annoyed.
It's the worst.
It's so rude. It's so rude. Painful.
There's nothing good about it.
Could leave a bruise.
Yeah, if you get them with, like, the tips of your nails, you'll leave a bruise every time.
And it's interpretive, too. That's what I like about this one, 312, the pinching.
Yeah, it could mean anything, really.
And if you tell people...
My pants are pinching up.
Yeah. You know? Oh, totally.
And if you tell people your girlfriend's abusing you by pinching you, they just laugh in your face.
Yeah. That is true. Not a lot of sympathy here.
No.
312 says, guys who still wear cigarettes behind their ears, so tacky.
I mean, I only have a problem with it if it's half a smoked cigarette. There's nothing worse than somebody who keeps half of a cigarette in their pocket or
If I'm loaned a cigarette, but I don't have a pack, I keep it in the elastic part of my hat.
Oh, that's smart.
That's smart.
Right here.
Because then you hold it on your head and it's not a show-offy type thing.
Right. And I have so much hair that it covers it all up.
I just like that this person's fine with smokers, but just like, ugh, why do you have to make it an accessory? You know, like
ears are for earrings only.
Smoking is fine, but it doesn't look cool when you wear one.
No need to show it off.
Yeah. Oh, you have money, you know?
I have $12 a pack money.
Yeah.
See, if I were a smoker, I'd just have them everywhere. It'd be like a style. It'd be a thing where you're totally. Like, oh, I've got 6 cigarettes on me because I'm rich.
Yeah, it's like peacocking.
Yeah.
Totally. It's the height of luxury.
Like mystery from whatever the pickup artist.
That will definitely be the future. You watch that. It'll be like, it'll be a status symbol to how many cigarettes are on you. The worst is having to eat a dozen cold, hard-boiled eggs that your kids died for Easter. Ooh.
Yeah,
I mean,
I don't like hard-boiled eggs in general.
I don't like wasting, but also, like, you don't have to eat them. They're not.
Make your kids eat them.
You can make some new eggs. Yeah, make a different egg. Get yourself a new egg.
You know who likes eggs? Foxes.
847 says, you know what's the worst? Snot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even the word is pretty bad.
That's a good word, snot.
But I do like I pick my nose sometimes. I'm not ashamed to admit
I'm
it.
I'm shocked to hear this.
But sometimes, you know, like when you get that booger that's also like in your face and you can just feel it, you can pull it.
You know
all
what's
the way
actually
out?
Pretty gross is if you don't pick your nose.
Yeah.
You can't tell that to kids. Up. They can't handle that kind of, you know what
I
mean?
Yeah,
I
can pick my nose whenever I want, Miss Calm.
Kids aren't ready for that kind of knowledge, but the truth is you better get in there, you know? Clear that sucker out.
This is we're enlightening.
Clean out that schnoz
of the area.
Yeah.
773 says having a political conversation with those of alternative opinions.
I mean, well.
Oh, I'm sorry that you don't want to have a discussion and you just want to sit in your echo chamber.
It is kind of the worst.
It is. I think having a political conversation can seem like the worst if you agree with the person.
If you don't agree with the person enough, that's also a bad. That's the worst because, I'm sorry, because in the comedy, it's as left as you can possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just 3/4 the way,
you're having people still
yell at you. And I'm like, I'm with you.
Yeah, right.
I'm still with you. We don't disagree on anything. I think everyone
should be allowed to do anything. That's okay.
Nobody understands how big of a feminist Tim McLaughlin is, and it's very frustrating.
The other day, I told my girlfriend in the car that she didn't have to get on birth control because it was her body and she could do whatever she wanted with it. And I said, post that on Facebook so everyone knows what kind of hero I am.
Yeah, it's always on Facebook. Yeah. That's what makes it the worst. Because I don't know why. Maybe it's because I think I'm better than everyone. But I really feel like the people who don't agree with me like also can't spell. And that gives me a lot of power.
That's
online.
True. And they use commas when they should be using semicolons. Yeah. Gross.
Yeah. The worst is when you're such a klutz that you knock over the same drink three times in 30 minutes.
I think that's just a drinking problem.
Yeah. I think you're an alcoholic.
It's a late night. A lot of people have been
224
drinking.
224 says, I'll one-up the snot. Three-year-old wiping snot all over his sleeve, then on me.
That's still
I
snot.
Love my son. They say, I love my son. I love my son. I love my son. They said three times.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so okay. Can you call the police and have them look at that house? Because yeah, that no. sounds like a text from a guy who just killed his son.
Sounds
so.
Like they're telling themselves that. I still love him. I still love him. No, I that's body just fluids
in the,
are gross.
That's just in the snot territory.
Yeah.
I get, you know what's the worst? I've been babysitting for a family, and I keep getting bruises on my chest because the kid, like, keeps in a bad place, like, just up on the top of my chest. Nothing, like, really
grabbing,
weird.
Huh?
But, yeah.
I was
like,
about to say, let's see him.
Yeah. There, it's right here. You can see it.
All right.
It's not anywhere gross. It's
all right. 312-981-7200. Rena Calm, Tim McLaughlin in studio. Let's get to these prizes and do our top three tonight. Of course, we've got to give away a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is the home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online, loumalnatis.com. Pair of tickets to the Tony Award-winning musical Disney's Mary Poppins. I gotta say Disney's Mary Poppins. Now playing through May 28th at the Mercury Theater, Chicago. Bring the whole family. Spend a jolly holiday with Mary Poppins and an irresistible cast of characters. Tickets at mercurytheater.com, chicago.com, or 773-325-1700. And finally, a package for four at Hawthorne Racecourse for the 59th Illinois Derby, presented by ExpressBet on Saturday, April 22nd. Packages include admission, program, buffet, and bar with domestic beer, wine, and soda. Get tickets online by 5 p.m. on April 20th at HawthorneRacecourse.com. All right, here we go. Third place tonight is going – let's go right to the Hawthorne Racecourse. Let's give them that.
Yeah.
Third place tonight, 630, people who walk into a tax office at 8:30 p.m. On the last day say they got a simple return, but it's not.
You know
and then
what?
When it's complete – they don't like the fees, they leave.
That person deserves a night on the town.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think that person could take – their money, because of how crappy that was, they can take it, they can go to the horse track, and they're going to win big. They're going to win the fee back.
That's right. They get it all back, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a gambling problem.
312. All right. So second place, get the Tony Award-winning musical Mary Poppins at
Disney's.
The Mercury Theater. Disney's, right? 312, the worst pinching.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
A lot of pinching at that show.
Yeah, right. Just a spoonful of sugar, not a pinch, you know?
That's right. There
yes.
And first place tonight, going to get the Lou Malnati's gift certificate because they're out of state. They're in Ohio. We have got to give it to Kenny, who was taking on the phone scammers by giving them Bill Cosby's information.
Oh, my God. So great.
That was great.
So great.
Kenny, that was pretty good. To then get to give Bill Cosby's information, then to gradually turn into Bill
him.
Cosby.
Yeah.
That's a great way to take on telemarketers. Well done, Kenny. Well done, Rena and Tim. You guys are great tonight. Thanks so much for playing the worst. We'll have you guys back this summer. Thanks again.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, man.
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Patty Vasquez up next. Here on 720 WGN. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN and WGNradio.com. Tomorrow night we're back with another show. Jamie Attenberg going to be on. Great author. Getting great work for her novel. She was on with us for her last novel, so it's awesome. It's like repeat. She's becoming a star, and she comes through the download, so we'll take it. And the Bulls won. Which is so cool.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they did.
I mean, I don't know when it starts to get real. You know, that's the problem with an 8-seed Chicago Bulls team. You're like, eh, once we get to maybe a 3-0 lead, we'll start paying attention. You know, like 2-0 is not enough.
If they win the series, why not, man?
If they win the series, maybe they got to win the series before we go, well, what's going on over at the United Center?
Rondo was solid. Wade's back.
Aren't they?
Butler's Butler.
I mean, they're built for this, right? I mean, they're veterans that only play when the lights are on. That's
I guess.
Oh, God.